Marlon James.
As a child, I read everything. I thought books were keeping secrets from me, and I just wanted to know what they were.
This Cultural Life with me, John Wilson, on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds, starts next Thursday morning at 11.
It's 6 o'clock on Friday, the 23rd of August. Good morning. This is Today with Justin Webb at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago and Michelle Hussein in London.
The main news this morning.
On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination.
Kamala Harris has called on America to move beyond bitterness and cynicism and chart a new way forward as she accepted her party's nomination for the presidency. We're here in Chicago. We're speaking to senior Democrats, to friends of the vice president, and to young female voters about the renewed possibility of a woman president.
To have a female candidate for young Gen Z voters, especially women, is going to be finally some sort of positive history. That's happening within our lifetimes. It's monumental.
Also on the programme, the energy regulator Ofgem is due to reveal within the hour how much energy bills will rise from October. We'll speak to them and to money-saving expert Martin Lewis. Ahead of the bank holiday weekend and its many festivals, Massive Attack are putting on a zero-waste, low-carbon gig. Our correspondent David Silito tries out how to get to the venue on his own steam.
It's quite a trek, and almost all of it uphill. Or you could try cycling. I said try.
And Gary's been speaking to the legendary football manager, Howard Wilkinson.
My father left school when he was 14 on a Tuesday, and he was down the pit on a Wednesday. And he made sure, as I was growing up, he kept reminding me that I was not going to work down the pit.
The BBC News is read by Jane Steele.
Kamala Harris has delivered her pitch to be the next US president, promising a new way forward and an opportunity to move past what she called the bitterness and cynicism. Addressing the Democratic convention in Chicago as it came to a close, Ms. Harris said she would be a leader for all Americans. And she warned that the consequences would be extremely serious if Donald Trump was returned to the White House in November's election. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, is in Chicago.
Kamala Harris had a lot to achieve with one 40-minute speech, introducing herself to Americans who don't know that much about her, explaining what she will do if she gets elected, and most importantly, looking and sounding like a president. She said this election was an opportunity for America to move beyond bitterness and division and chart a new way forward.
I promise to be a president for all Americans. You can always trust me.
Ms. Harris said she wanted to build a country in which everyone had the chance to succeed, accusing Donald Trump of being interested only in himself and his rich friends.
The consequences of putting Donald Trump back in the White House are extremely serious.
Kamala Harris has been running a sunny, optimistic campaign. This speech was less uplifting, more serious and sober, warning that Donald Trump would take the country backwards and hoping that voters will see her as the candidate of the future.
The energy regulator Ofgem is due to announce details in about an hour's time of its next price cap to take effect in October. Domestic energy prices are expected to rise, with 28 million households in England, Wales and Scotland affected by the increase. This report from our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey.
Ofgem changes the cap every 3 months. Energy prices fell in April and July, pulling them down to their lowest for 2 years. But with the wholesale costs paid by suppliers going up, bill payers now face an increase in prices in the run-up to winter. Forecasters suggest the annual bill for a household using a typical amount of gas and electricity will rise by about £150. Charities say finances will be further stretched because some government support is being wound down.
The former footballer Jermaine Genus has said there are two sides to every story after being sacked from the BBC as a presenter and pundit. It's understood the decision was made in response to complaints about his conduct. Jermaine Genus has appeared regularly on Match of the Day and The One Show. In an interview with Talk Sport, he said he was speaking to his lawyers about the dismissal.
I can't really talk about it. As you can probably see, I am not happy about it. But currently, as it stands, I'm going to have to let the lawyers deal with it. You know, there's two sides to every story.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has insisted there are no blank checks to deal with pay disputes in response to criticism of the government moves to end strikes involving public sector workers, junior doctors and train drivers. The Conservatives said ministers had caved to the unions, but in an interview with The Guardian, Ms Reeves dismissed the accusation. More details from our political correspondent, Nick Eardley.
The government says it wants to end disputes to prevent further economic damage, but offering train drivers an unconditional, backdated pay deal led to criticism that the new government was giving away too much too early. And some union leaders have made it clear that higher pay deals for some will likely mean higher demands from others. Rachel Reeves is now seeking to quash suggestions that Labour will be an easy negotiating partner. She told The Guardian Labour had not caved in to demands, that she and the Prime Minister set policy, not unions, and that there would be no blank cheques.
The search is expected to resume this morning for the final missing person who'd been aboard the yacht which sank off the coast of Sicily on Monday. It's believed to be Hannah Lynch, the daughter of the British entrepreneur Mike Lynch. Our Europe correspondent Jessica Parker reports from Sicily.
Six bodies have now been recovered after luxury yacht the Baysian sank during a heavy storm in waters off the fishing village of Porticello in the early hours of Monday morning. Of the 22 passengers and crew on board, 15 survived. The one person who remains missing is believed to be 18-year-old Hannah Lynch, the daughter of the British technology tycoon Mike Lynch. His body was recovered yesterday from the wreck of the vessel, which is lying on the seabed at a depth of 50 metres. While few details have been released about investigations, the authorities will likely want to examine what measures were taken to mitigate against bad weather, such as if access hatches were closed.
The Great Britain Paralympic sprint champion Richard Whitehead has told BBC News that NHS prosthetics need to improve to produce the next generation of gold medalists. Speaking ahead of the Paris Paralympics, which begin on Wednesday, he said current prescriptions did not allow many amputees to continue in sport.
Jane, thank you very much. Let us turn to the weather ahead of this bank holiday weekend. Darren Vetter's at the BBC Weather Centre. Morning, Darren.
Morning, Michelle. Well, we start with Storm Lillian, which is bringing some nasty weather this morning with some strong winds and some heavy rain. And it's going to be particularly windy across England and Wales, with the strongest of the winds for the rush hour likely to be across northern England and the far north of Wales. A widely gusts of 50, 60 miles an hour, unusual for this time of the year, but the winds could possibly be even higher than that. And we've still got some rain around as well for the rush hour. The heaviest of the rain will be in Scotland, but it will clear away very quickly, and the storm itself by mid to late morning will be out into the North Sea. And once we reach that time of the day, the winds will start to ease, and we're going to be left with a blustery west to southwesterly wind for much of the day, with some showers mainly for Scotland and Northern Ireland, where temperatures are going to be only 16 or 17 degrees at best. A few showers will come into the north of England and into West Wales, but the rest of England and Wales are likely to be dry with quite a bit of sunshine. Temperatures in England and Wales, 18 to 20 degrees, maybe making 22 or 23 in East Anglia and the southeast of England. So Storm Lillian, first thing this morning with the worst of the weather through the rush hour, and then things do tend to calm down a bit. Quick look at what's to come over the bank holiday weekend. We've got some rain in the southeast on Saturday, showers elsewhere, more rain coming in on Sunday, but it should be a better day on Monday.
Darren, thank you. 8 minutes past six is the time. Let's have our first look at the papers, and the ruling that the first drug to slow the progress of Alzheimer's should not be available on the NHS in England is the main news in The Telegraph. The paper reports that the organisation which made the decision did not take into account the costs of the disease to families and society. Daily Mail says the ruling has caused fury. The headline in The Express asks, why is it that only the rich can get the Alzheimer's wonder drug? The Daily Mirror describes the medication's benefits as sadly out of reach for most sufferers. And The Eye reports that NHS England has 27 other Alzheimer's drugs in advanced trials, which may be approved in the coming years.
The front page of The Times says magistrates in England and Wales have been directed to postpone the sentencing of offenders who are on bail and likely to be jailed in an attempt to ease prison overcrowding. The paper says the ruling will affect hundreds and possibly thousands of offenders. It says some magistrates have expressed scepticism about the plan, believing it to be a sticking plaster for problems in the criminal justice system.
The Financial Times reports that the drug manufacturer AstraZeneca is threatening to move a planned vaccine manufacturing site from Merseyside to Philadelphia because of the government's plans to reduce state aid for the project. The paper says the Chancellor wants to cut the amount on offer from £90 million to £40 million. The Treasury said it was in positive discussions with AstraZeneca, while the company said it was committed to the project in Liverpool.
The Guardian claims that Rachel Rees has dropped a hint that she may change the way debt is calculated in order to meet the government's self-imposed fiscal rules. The paper quotes the Chancellor saying the precise way to measure debt will be set out in the budget and that it is reasonable to borrow to invest. She also told the paper there was no blank cheque for pay deals. The Sun's editorial warns that further pay rises would fuel a wage spiral, destroying all hope of growth. The Mail says a poll has found voters think Sir Keir Starmer should have squared up to unions rather than appeasing them.
And the Telegraph reports another stumble for the director Francis Ford Coppola's new film Megalopolis, which he funded with more than $100 million of his own money. A trailer for the film has been pulled after it emerged. It included fake quotes. It cited negative reviews of some of the filmmaker's previous work, including The Godfather and Apocalypse Now. As the narrator says, genius is often misunderstood. But the quotes couldn't be found in the original reviews. The Guardian says one of those misquoted said, even if you don't like critics, we hardly deserve to have words put into our mouths.
The time is now 11 minutes past six.
Well, they wanted to catch the attention of Americans here at the Democrats' convention in Chicago to introduce Kamala Harris to the nation. She has just given her speech, she accepted the nomination. She has kicked off just over 2 months of frantic campaigning. Now let's turn to Emma Vardy, who was watching the whole thing unfold, and she began, didn't she, Emma, with biography?
She did, because this is a person who actually many Americans just don't know as well as they would if it was a candidate who'd been campaigning for months and months and doing rallies end on end. And I think that she ticked all the boxes that Democrats kind of would have wanted, talking about her background. She took the fight to Donald Trump using her experience as a prosecutor to say she'd be arguing the case against him. And that really sets the tone for the rest of the campaign ahead. I think she'll continue to contrast her vision, a picture of hope and optimism, as she says, against what Democrats say is that divisive, angry rhetoric of Donald Trump. And she would have been helped by all the celebrity endorsements this week, too, who can, of course, reach people politicians can't.
Yeah, and the whole point of the speech, I mean, it needed to go down well in the hall, didn't it? And obviously it did. But more importantly, it needed to go down well in the nation and to be seen by the nation.
Well, this is an event made for TV, isn't it? And it has to have that incredibly feel-good factor. All the balloons, the visions of the balloons raining down, the red, white and blue, the sort of patriotism. But what happens now is that although she's quite fresh to voters, she's now got to deal with the next few months of Republicans attacking her at every turn, deal with the potential threat of misinformation and things that get manipulated online. And next big moment, of course, is the debate, a live debate against Donald Trump, which will be a very different experience to performing in a very scripted and choreographed way that you get to do at a convention.
Yeah, and that debate does suggest to some people that it could be more important than they usually are. We've already had a debate, haven't we, which is done for a presidential candidate in Joe Biden. But the idea now that this debate that is coming up is peculiarly important this time round has sort of caught hold, hasn't it?
Well, you have heard people say in the past that, you know, live debates don't matter. People have made their minds up. Well, that really got proven wrong, didn't it? I mean, the last debate ended up with Joe Biden having to pull out of the race. So you now have one candidate in Donald Trump who people have seen time and time again, have heard his messages many times, contrasted against somebody who still feels very, very fresh and new, and which one of those people will get the advantage. Donald Trump oozes huge amounts of confidence, of course, when he takes to any sort of stage at all. He feeds off a crowd, whereas Kamala Harris is much more forensic, like a prosecutor. And there will be so much scrutiny on her for a debate, particularly because she's still sort of formulating her policies. She's been big on vibes, but light on policies and details so far.
Emma Vardy, with balloons popping all around her in the convention hall. Thank you.
Is that what it is? I was wondering, it sounded like some kind of sport in the background, but clearly they move fast, don't they, from the event to the clear-up. More from Justin.
We'll have cleaners around us before we leave at 9 o'clock.
Clearing you out, but hopefully not before nine. Let's turn to more news from here, because a BBC team has found hundreds of posts from people in the UK on a website which connects people exploring suicide and has been itself connected to a number of double suicides. Angus Crawford is the BBC's investigations correspondent. What did you find on this site, Angus?
Well, this particular site, I've been investigating for several years now. We know of hundreds of deaths connected to it, including at least four children in the UK. I mean, it supports suicide. It encourages, promotes and gives detailed instructions. But what we also found, it has a restricted members-only section where users can literally advertise for someone to die with. We spoke to one mother of a young man who died who described it as Tinder for suicide. So we created a false account and analysed this partner's thread, if you like, and we found more than 5,500 posts in the last 6 years, including 700 identified as from the UK, and we found a number of double suicides were linked to that thread.
Is that kind of material on a website legal? Can the government do anything about it?
Well, this is the huge question. Parents of the dead want to know why it hasn't been taken down already. The answer is, in some ways, it's in the simply too difficult to do tray. In the US, it's a question of freedom of speech. Here, it's about no organisation really taking ownership of the problem. But as you say, there are real hopes that the Online Safety Act will target just this content. But big problem is it doesn't come into force until the middle of next year. And many critics are now saying it simply isn't tough enough. Now, the new Labour government says it's really committed to this act and said to us intentionally encouraging or assisting suicide or serious self-harm is both devastating and illegal. And it says once the Online Safety Act is fully implemented, platforms will have to proactively remove this type of illegal content. So we'll see when it comes into force in the middle of next year.
Angus Crawford, thank you very much. Let us turn now to Felicity Hannah with the business news, including looking ahead to the energy bill, the Ofgem price cap announcement that we will get at 7 o'clock. Morning, Fliss.
Morning. Yes, so the announcement on the energy price cap, the latest price cap announcement, will come into force for the last 3 months of this year. Now, at the moment, the cap is set at £1,568 a year for a typical household. That is the lowest it's been for 2 years. The energy consultancy Cornwall Insight says that's probably going to rise by as much as £150 a year. Now, it is, Michelle, always worth a reminder that the cap refers to the amount a typical household in England, Scotland and Wales will pay annually. If you use more, you will, of course, pay more. Why is it likely to go up, though? Let's ask Greg Jackson, who's founder and CEO of Octopus Energy, which is the UK's biggest domestic energy supplier. He joins me now. Greg, good morning.
Good morning, Felicity.
Why are we likely to see a rise in the price cap?
Yeah, I mean, obviously this is bad news for so many people, especially as we're heading into winter. It's really driven by the fact we're still so dependent on the global gas market, and global gas wholesale prices are still three times higher than they were in 2020. And that feeds through not only into our gas price, obviously, but because our electricity price is set by gas, it puts up electricity costs too.
Okay, so we're likely to see energy bills then rising just before the first winter, where there's also going to be a means-tested winter fuel payment for pensioners. Are you worried about what that might mean for some of your customers?
Yeah, I think in context, it's still, prices are a long way below where they were, last winter. There's a lot companies can do to help. So, for example, we've introduced a support program for pensioners in particular, who are most affected by those changes. But fundamentally, the problem we've got is that the underlying energy costs are too high. If we carried on building onshore wind turbines in the 2010s, bills last year would have been something like £150 a year lower than they were. What we need to do is make sure that now the government have started to relax the planning restrictions, we can start building cheap British renewable energy. And then we need market reforms so that people get the benefits of that. Because at the moment, people aren't seeing the benefits of the renewables. So we need to build them and then reform the market so the price isn't set by gas. In fact, if we had prices that reflected the local supply of renewables, we'd have the cheapest electricity in Europe in Scotland. Every region would be cheaper. So there are things that can be done, and they need to be done quickly.
Now, since the last energy price cap announcement, we've had a change of government. Labour is developing GB Energy, a publicly owned energy company that it intends will drive that clean energy transformation, bring down bills that way. Is that something then that you welcome, or would that have an impact on a company like yours?
It's still early days to know what GB Energy is actually going to be doing, but it looks like it's going to be co-investing with private investors, so we can bring a lot more investment into the sector. That would be very welcome. And of course, if the government's co-investing, one would expect they'll also help ease the way to build some of these projects that have been stuck for so long. But our system is broken. There's a solar farm we want to build in County Durham, which I think we've got to wait 13 years to get a grid connection. There's a real problem here, because until we can build this new supply, costs are not going to come down.
Cornwall Insight, in their latest forecast, say that without significant intervention, this may well be the new normal. It sounds like you're concerned about that as well. What kind of intervention would you like to see?
Yeah, I think we need three things. So first of all, we need planning reform so that we can build new generation to bring new electricity. As you know, when you increase supply, costs come down. The second thing we need is grid reform, because as you know, like sometimes even you can build a new generation, you can't connect it. And the third thing we need is what we call market reform. So at the moment, we pay billions a year to do things like turning off wind farms when there's excess electricity. And we need market reform so that people get that power cheap instead of turning off those wind farms. And that really means locational pricing, so that we can build the infrastructure where it's needed to bring costs down more.
Now, that's interesting, isn't it? When you say that you increase supply and that brings price down, because as you already mentioned, that's not necessarily the case at the moment. Prices are set by the global market. So somewhere like Scotland that has a lot of different kinds of energy doesn't get cheaper energy as a result. Is that something you want to change?
Absolutely. Look, at the moment, it's kind of crazy that we have standing charges, which are far too high and vary by region. So Scotland pays the highest standing charges in Great Britain. But the unit rates don't reflect the fact that, for example, Scotland's got so much electricity it can generate itself to bring prices down there. But that kind of regional pricing would actually bring prices down everywhere. According to a major consultancy employed by the government, it would save consumers £50 billion by 2040.
Well, Ofgem is, of course, currently considering whether to change the standing charge billing system. That's where households pay a daily fee, even if they're not actually using any energy. Greg, thank you very much indeed for joining us.
Thank you.
That's Greg Jackson, founder and CEO of Octopus Energy. And Michelle will be talking to the boss of Ofgem just after that price cap announcement at 7 o'clock this morning. Now, it's that time of year when lots of people might be away on holiday, but central bankers are all flocking to Jackson Hole in Wyoming. Traders will be looking at what they say for any clues on interest rate cuts, particularly when the chair of the US Federal Reserve, Jerome Powell, speaks there later. The minutes from the latest meeting of the Fed suggest that America's central bank is confident inflation is moving in the right direction and that it thinks now might be the time to consider starting to cut rates from their 22-year high. Let's talk to Catherine Nice, who's chief European economist at PGIM Fixed Income. Catherine, good morning.
Good morning.
So is it a case then that the market is as confident as it can be that there will be a rate cut in September? It's just the size of the cut that they're debating now.
Yes, I think that's right. There's high conviction that interest rates in the U.S. are coming down. The question is all about the timing. How quickly will they come down and how aggressively will they come down? Is this reduction in interest rates going to look like the mirror image of what we saw with interest rates going on the way up? So I think this is the big question that markets are really grappling with.
Would a cut in US rates have any impact on people listening here in the UK?
financial conditions in the U.S. are hugely important for the rest of the world, just given the importance, the size of the U.S. economy, what the Fed decides really drives global financial conditions. And we've seen some of those stresses and strains here in Europe with the U.S. economy really firing on all cylinders with very high interest rates, and really having to compete for investor money. Central banks here, the UK and in Europe, have had to, you know, raise interest rates as well. So it is going to provide some relief, I think, for other economies through that channel. But secondly, very important, these reductions that we're expecting in interest rates in the U.S. will help support the U.S. economy, which, of course, is great for exporters like the U.K.
And, of course, the Governor of the Bank of England, Andrew Bailey, is also speaking at Jackson Hole. So I'm sure we'll be watching closely to see if there's any steer on when the next cut might be here in the U.K. Catherine Nice, Chief European Economist at PGIM Fixed Income, thank you very much indeed. Now, you can tell a lot about how businesses are feeling by how strongly they're recruiting. So what does it mean when we see recruitment firms struggling to maintain their profits? Well, Hays, the FTSE 250 listed recruiter, unveiled a 92% dip in annual pre-tax profits yesterday. It said that was down to increasingly challenging market conditions over the last 12 months. And it's not the only recruiter. We've seen similarly downbeat results across the recruitment sector from Page Group, from Robert Walters. Let's speak to Michael Barrington Hibbert, who's founder and CEO of the recruitment firm Barrington Hibbert Associates. Michael, good morning.
A very good morning to you, Felicity.
Do you recognise this picture?
Absolutely. As a business owner focused on executive search, we have seen very difficult trading conditions. But I think what's really important is I want to take your listeners back to a period of a really hot labour market over a period of 2020 to 2022, where organisations hired exponentially as there was a low interest rate environment, consumer confidence was up, and as a consequence, organizations were growing. Now, what I want to address here is what's impacted the likes of Hays, Michael Page, Robert Walters, is that their clients over the last 12 to 18 months, Felicity, have had to right size. And what I mean by that, they have grown very quickly and as a consequence have had to adapt their operating models as a consequence.
So you don't see this then as reflective of the current economic situation? You think this is perhaps because everybody got a bit overexcited in the past?
Well, I think it's the magnification of many aspects. So we have to look at the hot wage increased environment. We have to look at the inflationary environment. And also, as your previous speakers, Catherine mentioned, around interest rates. We grew up in an environment over 20 years of a low interest rate environment. And as a consequence, clients that have hired exponentially have had to deal with geopolitics, have had to deal with a high inflationary environment, but also having to service capital. And this has led to a situation where many organizations over the last 12 to 18 months have had to really focus on their restructuring. So a big impairment charge that Hays has had to deal with is almost 80 million pounds have come off their bottom line because they've had to restructure across their US, Germany and Australian business in order to remain competitive.
Briefly, Michael, if you can, UK growth has been better than a lot of people were expecting since the start of the year. Can we expect things to improve for recruitment?
100%. I think that the bottom line, when I speak to CEOs of FTSE 100 and FTSE 250 firms, they talk about survive to 25, Felicity. And what I mean by that, we talk about the cost savings that the likes of Hays have made. That is reflective of many organisations who feel very confident about the UK growth story and very much in a position when it comes to 2025 to grow more aggressively.
Michael Barrington Hibbert from Barrington Hibbert Associates, thank you.
Fliss, thank you. 28 minutes past six. Gary has the sport.
Michelle, good morning to you. England have a slender lead going into the second day of the first test against Sri Lanka. They'll resume this morning on 259 for six. That's 23 runs ahead of the tourists. Jamie Smith is 72 not out. And correspondent Jonathan Agnew looks ahead.
An intriguing and unpredictable day is in store, one that could determine the fate of this test match. If England start well and Smith continues his fluent innings, England will post a lead that could overwhelm the Sri Lankans in the notoriously difficult third innings. However, if Sri Lanka can restrict England to a manageable lead and knuckle down with the bat, they have the chance to make things very difficult in the fourth innings on a wearing pitch. And that was evident yesterday in two deliveries from Jayasuriya that spun very sharply. Brook was stunned by the first, which took his off stump for 56, and Wokes could only nod in appreciation when he was also bowled by the left armer for 25. Smith has played beautifully once again. He really has taken a test cricket very quickly, and he will have his first century in his sights.
Test match special starts at 10 o'clock. Andrew Flintoff's son Rocky made his debut in the county championship for Lancashire, scoring a creditable 32. Lancashire were dismissed for 204 and Surrey at 83 without loss. Well, Chelsea were booed off the pitch at half-time, but they went on to beat Servette 2-0 in their Europa Conference leg, first leg tie. John Southall watched the match at Stamford Bridge.
So Enzo Maresco has his first Chelsea win. He shuffled his sizeable pack and made nine changes from the Manchester City defeat, but he will know it wasn't a wholly convincing Chelsea performance. The team were booed off at half-time at 0-0. Welcome to Chelsea, Enzo. This just his second game in charge. Christopher Nkunku's penalty early in the second half opened the scoring, the first goal of the Maresca era. Noni Madueke added the second, 14 minutes from time, to give Chelsea what should be an unassailable lead. Servette should have taken a goal away from Stamford Bridge. They had their chances, especially late on in the game. But Chelsea have that two-goal advantage, and that should be enough.
And in their European ties, Kilmarnock lost 2-0. Hearts conceded a goal in the 96th minute and were beaten 1-0, but both teams have home legs to come. The second round of the Women's Open Golf Championship starts in an hour. England's Charlie Hull leads by one stroke and will go live to St Andrews in an hour. It's the second day of the York e-ball meeting, so two tips at 2:25, number 5, at Quickthorne, 3:35, number 9, Asfora.
Gary, thanks.
On BBC iPlayer.
We are not in control of this situation.
We know that these shootings are very upsetting for the community.
It's a gathering storm, and I'm worried about anyone who's at the centre of it.
There will be consequences.
And this culture or code of not grassing, we are way beyond that now.
They're all turning on each other.
This ends before it begins.
Revenge runs in the family.
I go down, you go down.
Blood for blood.
Put them down.
We've been in danger before.
But this is different, Rory. Look at me. This is different.
Sherwood, Series 2.
It's on a knife edge out there.
Start Sunday on BBC iPlayer.
The time is now just after 6:30. You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4, where Jane Steele has the news.
Kamala Harris has formally accepted her party's nomination to be the presidential candidate in November's US election. Speaking at the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, the current vice president said she would reform immigration, cut taxes for the middle class, and protect abortion rights. Ms. Harris also warned of what she called extremely serious consequences if Donald Trump were to win. The energy regulator Ofgem is to announce details shortly of its next price cap to take effect in October. Domestic energy prices are expected to rise, with 28 million households in England, Wales and Scotland affected. Currently, the energy bill for the average household is around £1,568 a year. The television presenter and football pundit Jermaine Genus has said he is consulting his lawyers after being sacked by the BBC. It's understood he was dismissed following allegations of inappropriate behaviour. The former England player, who presented The One Show and regularly appeared for Match of the Day, has been taken off air with immediate effect. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has rejected accusations from the Conservative Party that the government is caving to unions following moves to end strikes involving public sector workers, junior doctors and train drivers. Ms. Reeves has insisted there are no blank cheques to deal with pay disputes. Rescue teams are continuing to search for the final person who is still missing after a luxury yacht capsized off the coast of Sicily on Monday. The bodies of five people, including that of the tech tycoon Mike Lynch, has been discovered so far. It's thought Mr. Lynch's 18-year-old daughter is the last person yet to be found. A reigning Paralympic champion has told BBC News that improvements need to be made to prosthetics offered by the NHS if Great Britain wants to produce the next generation of gold medalists. Speaking ahead of the Paris Paralympics, the sprinter Richard Whitehead said current access to prosthetics did not allow many amputees to continue in sport.
The NHS doesn't routinely provide sports prosthetics to adults.
We'll hear from him later on in the programme on that very subject. Thank you, Jane. We will have a figure at 7 o'clock on the energy price cap for homes in England, Wales and Scotland for the 3 months from October. There are strong indications in advance that bills will see a sharp rise. The new government has made winter fuel help worth between £1 and £300 means tested in England and Wales. Ian Watson is our political correspondent. So we'll know the figure soon, Ian, but are there potential political difficulties over that decision arising from it for the government?
Oh, no doubt there is, Michelle. First thing to say is that when we get the announcement of that cap, I'm fully expecting Labour to blame the last government, to say they haven't moved quickly enough towards green and cheaper sources of energy. Nonetheless, the big political problem is, as you've been pointing out, if this cap is raised and winter fuel payments are worth between £1 and £300 for pensioners, the decision by Rachel Reeves to take that money away from anyone who isn't on benefits, who doesn't claim pension credit, will come into sharp focus. We already know privately that some Labour MPs are very concerned about this. They feel the ground wasn't laid for this announcement. Some of them were blindsided by it. And there are concerns that where Labour had actually been narrowing the gap with the Conservatives in support amongst the over 65s, that might well be reversed. So far, as I say, most of this has been done privately. We'll see, I think, perhaps some public criticisms quite soon. Already one Labour minister in the Welsh Government has talked about the risks of increasing pensioner poverty. So there will be some new pressure on Rachel Reeves. But I think the other difficulty for Labour is this has given the Conservatives a bit of an in here. They're trying to build a narrative and say effectively that here's Labour paying the union paymasters as they would see it. Rachel Reeves, of course, as we just heard, saying, look, no blank cheque for the unions. But that's what the Conservatives say they're doing, and taking money away from pensioners. Now, there is a drive, of course, to get more people to claim pension credit and therefore be eligible for the winter fuel payment. But whether that is quite enough remains to be seen.
More on this after 7 o'clock, and we'll also hear from Martin Lewis after 8:30 on a different way that he thinks the new way of doing winter fuel payments could be put through.
24 minutes to 7, the Indian Prime Minister Narendra Modi is in Ukraine. Nick Beek, our Europe correspondent, is on the line. And he went very controversially, didn't he, to Moscow. Nick, why is he in Ukraine now?
Good morning, Justin. Well, I tried to ask Prime Minister Modi that just a few minutes ago about the purpose of his visit. He didn't answer. He kept on walking and continued to enjoy what was a very warm and noisy welcome from a strong Indian contingent in the crowd here. Officially, they're saying this trip's all about boosting economic ties and other sort of cooperation. But you're absolutely right that the background to this visit is that Mr. Modi was in Russia 6 weeks ago, and that trip did not go down well with the Ukrainians. That's because Narendra Modi was seen warmly embracing Vladimir Putin on a day that Russian missiles killed more than 40 people across this country and hit a children's hospital in the capital, Kyiv, here in this city. And at the time, President Zelensky said it was, to quote him directly, a huge disappointment to see the leader of the world's largest democracy hug the world's most bloody criminal. So I think, Justin, this trip to Ukraine by Mr. Modi can be seen as an attempt to keep Western partners on side. He's repeatedly called for peace in Ukraine, but has failed to condemn Russia's invasion. And it's worth remembering, India still has really close ties with Russia. India buys the majority of its weapons from Moscow. It's increased the amount of discounted Russian crude oil in imports after the West applied sanctions. But that said, Mr. Modi is the first international leader to visit Kyiv since Ukraine's surprise incursion across the border into Russian territory itself earlier this month. So that may be significant.
And he didn't have to go. You do wonder whether there is something more to it, that possibly India could become involved in moves towards, at least talks about talks, that might one day take place between Kyiv and Moscow.
Yes, I think the Indians, certainly in their briefing, they're saying that they're not coming with some sort of peace plan or a roadmap towards some sort of agreement in the way that maybe the Chinese have suggested that they're in a position to broker a peace. But I think this works for Mr. Modi coming here. Also for President Zelensky too, the fact that he's able to draw on Western support, but also look to India as a major economy, someone who's coming to talk to him today. And, of course, all the while, they'll be discussing the latest that's happened with the incursion into Russia. We know that that's sort of stalled in the last few days or so. The Ukrainians seeming to target bridges now and consolidate the land that they've gained in this very rapid early advance. And all the while, President Putin's saying there will be some sort of retribution for this. We haven't seen this mass redeployment of Russian troops from the front line in Ukraine itself, which the Ukrainians were really hoping for to try and ease the pressure there. That might come in the days to come, or it might not. But certainly President Putin has said there will be some sort of response. And all the while, both the Ukrainians, but also the Americans here in Kyiv are warning that there's an increased risk of Russian drones and missiles over the next 48 hours or so, right, because it's Ukraine's Independence Day this weekend. But okay. I don't think we expect to see anything while Mr. Modi's here, Justin.
No, well, indeed. Nick Beek in Kyiv. Thank you.
Let us turn to the papers. And the Sun and the Mirror both lead on Jermaine Gina's being sacked from the BBC. The BBC has said very little about it other than confirming he is no longer part of the presenting lineup. But there is some more on the allegations against him in the newspapers. The Sun says it was a female colleague who raised concerns over alleged flirty texts, and others came forward amid a probe into digital communications. The Mirror quoting Jermaine Gina saying last night there are two sides to every story and he is speaking to his lawyers, but also with a source within the BBC telling the Mirror any hint of workplace misconduct and they have to come down very hard on it like the ton of bricks. That's with the various scandals that have beset the BBC of late. And the Mirror says the BBC received a complaint about text messages sent by Gina's last month.
The American papers all covering, of course, the events of the last few hours here in Chicago, with Kamala Harris accepting the nomination of her party as its presidential candidate. But the Chicago Tribune focusing as well on something that didn't happen, which was the appearance of Taylor Swift, which I'm not sure was ever really on the cards, but was hugely rumoured at one stage. I know I was excited. Friendship bracelets were made, they said, and actually friendship bracelets exchanged in the hall, which they were apparently going to do anyway, but they did in huge numbers. But Taylor Swift herself, as the Chicago Tribune points out, never showed. The Wall Street Journal devoting its space, not to Taylor Swift, as you would imagine, but to Kamala Harris and to her mapping out of policy plans, which they say are not going to be that ambitious. The appetite for ambitious efforts, they say, is not there. And the New York Times, much more enthusiastic about it, as you would expect. It is very much a Democrat-supporting paper these days. Her speech, she said, alternated between calls for unity and stinging rebukes of former President Donald J. Trump as an unserious man.
And our main news this morning is that Kamala Harris has accepted the Democratic Party nomination for U.S. president, telling the convention that the U.S. election is a chance to move past bitterness and division and pledging that she would be a president for all Americans. Now, the organisation that represents the UK's fresh produce sector, fruit, vegetables, cut flowers and plants, is warning that those imported from the EU, and a lot do fall into that category, will get more expensive from January unless the government delays border checks due to come in January next year. The Fresh Produce Consortium has written to the Environment Secretary Steve Reid about this, and Nigel Jenny, its chief executive, joins us now. Good morning.
Good morning.
What is the assurance that you haven't yet received? What would you like the government to do, which they haven't yet agreed to?
In essence, this is a hospital pass from the previous government, frankly, is that we are, as an industry, we are simply waiting for confirmation of when these checks will begin to occur and which products will be within the controls. And we simply don't have it at this time after years of waiting.
And despite meetings that you've had with the department?
Absolutely. Recently, the previous government held a further consultation to consider removing a large volume and a large range of fresh produce from these regulations. But that decision has not yet been confirmed. So as an industry, we're preparing for something, or potentially preparing for something, which could be huge volumes, perhaps 2 million tonnes of fresh produce. So to put that in context, that's over 2,000 vehicles a week coming to the UK. If what they're asking for in the consultation occurs, that will reduce substantially. So we're asking our European partners and the UK industry to prepare for something that may not happen at huge cost to themselves and ultimately consumers.
Okay, but it needs to happen at some point, doesn't it? These checks do need to come in because they are a consequence of Brexit.
Oh, absolutely. We're not arguing or questioning that this shouldn't happen. All we're looking for is a cost-effective border solution and a clarity of when they will be implemented and which products will be impacted.
But either way, whenever they happen, say it's July next year or January next year, at that point, will the cost of these extra checks or the slowing down effect that they have on imports, will that necessarily mean that the costs we pay as consumers go up?
Yes, because there's two aspects here. On the basis of the regulations are based on risk from a biosecurity point of view, so a risk of potential pests and diseases. If the government confirms that many of these products are low risk, the controls don't need to happen and the costs don't need to be incurred. However, what we should remember, the border strategy that has been adopted by the previous government is so enormously expensive, those costs cannot be absorbed by the industry when the industry for years has invested its own hard cash, not government grants, not taxpayers' money, into its own solutions, which are approved by government and are now being failed to be used effectively by the government. So as an industry, we've been proactive, we have solutions, we have cost-effective solutions to ensure UK consumers can continue to enjoy great fresh produce at affordable prices, but we are being undermined by our own government.
Okay, so you want some certainty. And the statement that we've got from the government talks about being committed to improving trade and investment and that risk-based checks on certain imports are essential. There is a suggestion, though, from what they've said to the I newspaper, that they are reviewing the date at which things change. Is that your understanding?
Well, that's great to see the eyes covering that, and it's great, I would assume, that the government has made that statement to them. You know, we would like that clarification directly to ourselves, please. But at the same point, that could well be great news. But we also have to reflect on, for the goods that are already subject to the controls, which is plants, it's seeds, it's cut flowers, the costs and delays to industry, which are avoidable, are enormous. The government fees that they are levying on the industry are eye-wateringly expensive.
Okay. Nigel Jenny from the Fresh Produce Consortium. Thank you.
40 minutes to seven. Half of Kamala Harris's speech here in Chicago was devoted to introducing herself to the nation, the other half to setting out in broad terms the kind of nation that she wanted to build. And Emma Vardy saw the whole thing unfold.
A month ago, many people did not envisage this moment. America's lesser-known second-in-command propelled into the starring role. Now Kamala Harris is the woman Democrats believe can make history by becoming the first female president of the United States.
On behalf of everyone whose story could only be written in the greatest nation on earth, I accept your nomination.
She offered Americans a chance to move beyond the highly polarized politics that have defined recent years.
I will be a president who unites us around our highest aspirations, a president who leads and listens, who is realistic, practical, and has common sense, and always fights for the American people. From the courthouse to the White House, that has been my life's work.
And she took the fight to her opponent with a warning.
Donald Trump is an unserious man. But the consequences of putting Donald Trump back in the White House are extremely serious.
Women's bodies, she said, would be policed when it comes to America's most divisive issue.
He plans to create a national anti-abortion coordinator and force states to report on women's miscarriages and abortions. Simply put, they are out of their minds.
With the fourth day of protests outside the convention center, Kamala Harris finally addressed the war in Gaza. Anger over Joe Biden's handling of the conflict threatens to cost the Democrats support. She reiterated her support of Israel.
The people of Israel must never again face the horror that a terrorist organization called Hamas caused on October 7.
But emphasized calls for the end of suffering in Gaza.
And the Palestinian people can realize their right to dignity, security, freedom, and self-determination.
What about us? What about all the times you said you had the answer?
A string of celebrities have thrown their support behind the current vice president.
What about all the broken, happy ever afters?
Though the convention finale wasn't the Beyoncé or Taylor Swift concert some had been hoping for. But it didn't stop delegates dancing on the floor as balloons rained down from above. Polls suggest Kamala Harris has taken the lead in this race. But Republicans have attacked her as too liberal, and there are fears about the economy and the US border that play to Donald Trump's strengths. There is still a lot to overcome if her dream of a new era for America is to be realised.
Emma Vardy reporting there from Chicago. The time is 10 to 7. Yemen has for years been in the grip of one of the world's worst humanitarian crises, with a civil war that has a Saudi-led coalition backing the government of Yemen against Houthi rebel forces. Now a UNICEF report is warning of how more children in government-held areas are suffering malnutrition, stunting their growth, and also they are being deprived of schooling. Peter Hawkins is UNICEF's representative in Yemen and is on the line now from the capital, Sana'a. Peter, can you explain why there's been this deterioration in government-held areas?
The situation continues to be an emergency situation. 18.2 million people across the board, across the country, who are in need. And what has happened in this case is that the children on the coastal plain, where water has been compromised, healthcare has been compromised, because they do not have access to the health centers because of landmines. And the vaccination rates have dropped dramatically. But above all, their livelihoods have been compromised by the conflict, by the economic collapse. And therefore, it's inevitable that the children's nutritional status has deteriorated quite quickly.
Is there aid that can come into these areas from the coast?
Indeed, and for the past 10 years, as you said, we've had a major international support mechanism which has brought aid across the country. Now, that has stabilized many people and many families, but the situation is so severe that the fragility, when you have floods, when you have lean periods like now, but also when you have interruptions on food aid, when you have interruptions on cash, it is very, very difficult. And this is why it deteriorated quite quickly.
And when it deteriorates, the impact on children, there's this very sobering figure that's come from this report of 48% of under fives being stunted. Can you explain what that means? That means not getting enough food for their bodies and their brains to grow.
That's exactly right. And it's for the first 2 years of their life, they don't get the right level of nutrients into their body for them to be able to grow. And this is the underlying problem that of fragility that we're faced with. So when we have shocks, as we do at the moment, that fragility turns into a real dramatic shock for the children. So we are responding all over the country with nutritional supplies so that children can survive, with vaccination, so that they can be protected against diseases like measles and polio. And we're trying to ensure that the food distribution and the cash, because cash is so important in these times, to give disposable income to families to be able to buy food to look after their children. So as of next week, we'll be distributing, UNICEF will be distributing $65 million worth of unconditional cash into 1.45 million families. Now, this will have a significant impact in trying to sustain and stabilize the population. And then later in the year, in December, we'll do another round to be able to help the population grow a bit more. But what we do need now is food distribution urgently.
Peter Hawkins from UNICEF in Yemen. Thank you.
It's just come up to 5 to 7 here in Chicago. The traffic's been awful, but at least they have the excuse here of 40,000 Democrats in town. This bank holiday, we in the UK face some traffic conditions that are also tricky, caused not by 40,000 Democrats, but by the weather, and in part by the numbers of us taking to the roads. And Edmund King, president of the AA, is on the line. Morning, Edmund.
Good morning, Justin.
What's going to happen? Let's deal with the weather, first of all, because that is going to fade as an issue, but it's an issue at the moment.
Well, it is an issue at the moment. There's a lot of rain, there's a lot of wind, particularly in the north of England, and that will affect traffic. We did a survey of about 11,000 drivers asking them what their intentions are this weekend, and we actually find a sensible third are actually going to stay at home and do a bit of gardening, potter around and avoid the roads. And of those that are traveling, three quarters are traveling less than 50 miles. So, you know, going to local events, perhaps local football matches, there's quite a few music concerts on around the country, there's Carfest near Basingstoke that supports children in need. So there's a lot of events going on. We think today will be the busiest, Friday, people getting away. It's the last bank holiday before Christmas. And last bank holiday at the AA, we dealt with about 41,000 breakdowns, and it was things like tyres, batteries, engine problems. So as ever, we're advising people to check out their car before they travel, and if they do break down, it's twice as quick to contact us using an app rather than phoning up.
Let's go from the car to the politics of driving and what the government has been saying in the last day or two, hasn't it, about 20 mile per hour zones and low traffic neighbourhoods, etc., etc. Basically, they're not going to get in the way if councils want to go ahead. Your view?
Well, I think on that, what they're saying, it should be up to local authorities to decide. And as long as there are full consultations with local people, I think that's the vital thing. Because if people look at 20 mile an hour speed limits outside schools, recreation grounds, they can totally understand that and they can see that working. I think where it went slightly wrong, where we had massive blanket reductions in speed and blanket restrictions, and that did cause problems. I think you need to take the people with you. So hopefully that's what they will be doing.
Right. So the government's announcement that the Transport Secretary just made does not cause you in and of itself any concern?
Well, no, not really. I mean, we accept that in urban areas, you know, we need more people to walk, to cycle, to use public transport. And where there are problems, you know, road safety is still a major issue with up to 5 people a day killed on the road. So, you know, we are supportive of things to reduce that carnage on the roads. And if that means slowing traffic down where it's needed, that is fine. But you need to get a balance. You still need roads for movement. People still need to get around, avoiding congestion. And we still have some concerns with smart motorways, the safety aspects of that. So we hope the government will actually review those smart motorways, because motorists are still incredibly concerned if they break down in a live lane and can't get to an emergency area.
Edmund King, thank you. And at 7:03, let us hear what is going on in the weather and indeed what is likely to go on in the next few days from Darren Bett. Morning again, Darren.
Only time for today. we've got some stormy weather around. Storm Lillian is going to be a short-lived storm. It's bringing some wet and some windy weather. The windiest weather is going to be for England and Wales. So far, the strongest winds have been Wales in the southwest, but over the next few hours, for the rush hour, the winds are going to strengthen in northern England. Gusts of 50, 60 miles an hour quite widely, maybe even higher than that, which will bring some disruption. Currently, the heaviest the rain is in Scotland, but with the storm moving away quickly out into the North Sea, by mid to late morning, things will be starting to calm down. And through the rest of the day, we're going to have some fairly brisk west to southwesterly winds, bringing showers mainly to Scotland and Northern Ireland, one or two into western parts of Wales and the northwest of England. Temperatures, a little disappointing. Scotland, Northern Ireland, 16, 17 degrees at best. England and Wales, 18 to 20 Celsius. A bit warmer in East Anglia in the southeast, 22 or 23. Degrees here.
Darren, thank you. Tomorrow morning, Jay Rayner is going to be here with some gastronomic delights.
On the Kitchen Cabinet, I've assembled a delicious panel of experts to answer your culinary conundrums.
What constitutes a hearty vegan meal?
They'll be serving up their tastiest recipes.
I mean, the garlic, which is spoon feed me that.
As we broadcast from some fabulous food locations with interesting gastronomic histories.
It's a town known for many things, but the biggest is the presence of the British Army.
So this is a 24-hour ration pack.
I've given a sniff to the vegetarian all-day breakfast. I would describe it as... ooh. Baked bean heavy.
I would really recommend not smelling the food.
The Kitchen Cabinet with me, Jay Rayner, on Saturday mornings at 10:30 on Radio 4 and BBC Sounds.
Coming up in the next hour on this programme, more from Kamala Harris's keynote speech to the convention here. Did she do enough to convince the nation that she should be president? You are listening to Today on Radio 4 with Michelle Hussain and Justin Webb. It's 7 o'clock on Friday, the 23rd of August. The headlines this morning, Kamala Harris has said the US election is a fight for the country's future as she closed the Democratic Party convention with a pledge to move past bitterness and division. The energy regulator is announcing its new price cap for millions of households with a big rise expected. We'll hear from the head of Ofgem just after 7. And the sacked BBC presenter, Jermaine Jenas, says he is speaking to his lawyers. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
Kamala Harris has delivered her pitch to be the next US president, promising to chart a new way forward. Addressing the Democratic convention in Chicago as it came to a close, Ms. Harris said she would be a leader for all Americans, and she warned that the consequences would be extremely serious if Donald Trump was returned to the White House in November's election. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, was among the crowds listening in Chicago.
Kamala Harris had a lot to achieve with one 40-minute speech, introducing herself to Americans who don't know that much about her, explaining what she will do if she gets elected, and most importantly, looking and sounding like a president. She said this election was an opportunity for America to move beyond bitterness and division and chart a new way forward.
I promise to be a president for all Americans. You can all...
Ms. Harris said she wanted to build a country in which everyone had the chance to succeed, accusing Donald Trump of being interested only in himself and his rich friends, and saying this election is also about the future of American democracy.
Donald Trump is an unserious man. But the consequences of putting Donald Trump back in the White House are extremely serious.
Kamala Harris has been running a sunny, optimistic campaign. This speech was less uplifting, more serious and sober, warning that Donald Trump would take the country backwards and hoping that voters will see her as the candidate of the future.
The energy regulator Ofgem is announcing details of its next price cap to take effect in October. Domestic energy prices are expected to rise, with 28 million households in England, Wales and Scotland affected by the increase. This report from our cost of living correspondent Kevin Peachey.
Ofgem changes the cap every 3 months. Energy prices fell in April and July, pulling them down to their lowest for 2 years. But with the wholesale costs paid by suppliers going up, bill payers now face an increase in prices in the run-up to winter. Forecasters suggest the annual bill for a household using a typical amount of gas and electricity will rise by about £150. Charities say finances will be further stretched because some government support is being wound down. Cost cost of living payments for those on means-tested benefits ended in February. Winter fuel payments are being withdrawn from 10 million pensioner households in England and Wales this time around, a move the government said was forced on it by the public finances it was left with. The charity Citizens Advice says it's bracing itself for a challenging winter.
And we've just heard that rise is around 10%, which is equated to £150 for the average household. The television presenter and football pundit Jermaine Genus has said he's consulting his lawyers after being sacked by the BBC. He was dismissed following allegations of inappropriate behaviour. The former footballer, who presented The One Show and regularly appeared on Match of the Day, has been taken off air with immediate effect. Here's our culture reporter Noor Nanji.
Jermaine Genus said there were two sides to every story after he was sacked by the BBC following complaints about workplace conduct. Speaking to TalkSport Radio, he said he was going to let his lawyers deal with the situation. He declined to give any further details of the allegations against him or to say whether his career would continue after he was taken off air at two primetime shows, Match of the Day and The One Show. BBC News understands that the former footballer's contract was terminated earlier this week because of allegations relating to workplace behaviour, after issues involving digital communications such as texts were raised with the corporation a few weeks ago. Jermaine Genus also works for TalkSport, but the radio station has said he won't be presenting there again in the immediate future.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has insisted there are no blank cheques to deal with pay disputes in response to criticism of agreements reached to end strikes involving public sector workers, junior doctors and train drivers. The Conservatives said ministers had caved to the unions, but in an interview with The Guardian, Ms Reeves dismissed the accusation. More details from our political correspondent, Nick Hurtley.
The government says it wants to end disputes to prevent further economic damage, but offering train drivers an unconditional, backdated pay deal led to criticism that the new government was giving away too much too early. Senior Conservatives have gone as far as to claim that ministers had been played by what they called union paymasters. And some union leaders have made it clear that higher pay deals for some will likely mean higher demands from others. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, is now seeking to quash suggestions that Labour will be an easy negotiating partner. She told The Guardian Labour had not caved in to demands, that she and the Prime Minister set policy, not unions, and that there would be no blank cheques. The coming months may give us more of a sense of what Labour is prepared to offer to avoid further damaging industrial action.
The Indian Prime Minister is visiting Ukraine 1 month after he made a controversial trip to Moscow and hugged President Putin. Narendra Modi has retained close political and economic links with Moscow since the full-scale invasion of Ukraine 2.5 years ago, and India still buys the majority of its weapons from Russia. But he is also trying to strengthen ties with Western allies. From Kiev, Nick Beek reports.
Prime Minister Modi has repeatedly called for peace in Ukraine, but has failed to condemn Russia's invasion. Last month, in a trip to Moscow, he warmly embraced President Putin on a day that Russian missiles killed more than 40 people across Ukraine and hit a children's hospital here in the capital. President Zelensky said it was a huge disappointment to see the leader of the world's largest democracy hug the world's most bloody criminal. Narendra Modi is the first international leader to visit Kyiv since Ukraine's surprise incursion into Russian territory earlier this month. President Putin says those actions will be punished.
The government says it is determined to take action against websites which encourage suicide. It was responding to a BBC investigation into a forum where more than 700 British people have advertised for a partner to die with. Predatory men were also found to have used the forum to target vulnerable women. Angus Crawford reports.
The forum, which we're not naming, contains a members-only section where users can advertise for a partner to die with. An analysis shows more than 5,000 posts there in the last 6 years. Of those, 700 users identified themselves as being from the UK. The investigation identified a number of double suicides connected to the site. The government says encouraging suicide is devastating and illegal. It claims the Online Safety Act, when fully in force, should tackle this kind of content.
A new vaccine which primes the immune system to recognise and fight lung cancer is being tested for the first time on patients in the UK. It's designed to work in a similar way to many COVID-19 vaccines. Scientists say the treatment could improve survival rates and hope it might eventually become the standard of care worldwide. 20 patients in Britain are expected to take part in the trial. The Paralympic sprint champion Richard Whitehead has told the BBC that NHS prosthetics need to improve if Great Britain is to produce the next generation of gold medalists. Speaking ahead of the Paris Paralympics, he said current prescriptions did not allow many amputees to continue in sport. Here's our disability correspondent Nikki Fox.
Richard Whitehead believes too many disabled people are held back from living active lives because of barriers like extra costs and a lack of equipment. He wants more adults to have access to sports prosthetics and says what is currently offered to patients on the NHS is not fit for purpose, as they often restrict movement and cause discomfort, leading many to opt out of sport.
For an able-bodied person to be able to run, the equipment you need is trainers. You get to a sports shop in your local community, you get them. For an amputee, you have to go to a prosthetic clinic. That process needs to be a lot easier.
An NHS England spokesperson said the health service provides a range of prosthetics to those who have lost limbs and that many fitness and physical activities can be carried out without sport-specific prosthetics.
Nikki Fox reporting.
Jane, thank you very much. 9 minutes past seven is the time. We've just had the latest energy price cap figures for domestic bills in Great Britain. The typical household will now pay £150 more a year as a 10% increase on current annual bills comes in from October to the end of January. It comes as winter fuel help is axed for most pensioners. We'll hear from an MP in a moment, but first Jonathan Brearley, the head of the regulator Ofgem, which is responsible for the cap, on where they have set it and why.
I talk to many, many families, and I know that today's news is not going to be welcome. What we're announcing today is that the price cap will go by around 10% in October, and that's driven principally by the change we're seeing in the international gas prices and that feeding through to our bills. Now, what I'd say to anyone that is concerned about this is there are things that you can do. So, first of all, please do make sure that you're getting access to all the state benefits you're entitled to. The government said earlier this week that almost a million people are not claiming pension credit when they can do so. Second, do talk to your energy company. We have rules in place that means they must give you support. They should give you flexibility in the way you pay. And they should also be making sure you have access to further financial help and support. And finally, the market is beginning to unwind. It's not as it was, but there are better value deals emerging. So look into the market itself and see if a fixed deal is better for you.
Can you just spell out what that 10% increase will mean for the average or typical household? How much will their annual bill now be?
So their annual bill will increase by around £150. So it's going up from 1568 to 1717. And this, in a sense, that means that there is a big change there for the average household. It's about £12 a month is what we've calculated. Now, I just want to emphasise, though, that is the average household. What you need to do is look at your own bill and multiply that by the 10% I've described before. We have seen some confusion when we've talked about the average household previously.
People will have thought or hoped that the price shock caused by Ukraine is over, or at least has settled. This shows us that that's not the case.
Look, I completely agree in a sense. So first of all, we should say the market is a lot better than those 2022 and 2023 years where we saw incredible prices. So things are better and they are more stable. But I think what we need to accept is that this situation of volatile gas prices being certainly higher than they were pre-crisis, is one that's likely to be around for a long time. Now, I always say it's a fool that predicts the gas price, so I don't know that's the case, but I think government, Ofgem, the sector and consumer groups need to see this as a long-term, not a short-term problem.
So likely to be around for a long time, this high price scenario. So we should prepare then for another increase in January?
Well, we don't make predictions about what might happen in January. And as I say, the market is volatile, so it's very, very hard to predict what might happen. But while we remain on gas, while we remain reliant on these international markets, this is the sort of situation we'll be in. The way out of this, though, the way we get to a better energy system is to build a low-carbon, more stable, homegrown, renewable energy system. So we are very excited about the government's goal of getting to net zero by 2030 for electricity, not just because we're enthusiastic about climate change, but because we think that will be better for customer and better for bills, and certainly will deliver us a more stable system.
But does that feed into bills in any meaningful or significant way in the next 2 years?
Well, when you look at the investment that's needed, there's a great deal of investment that's needed, and that will take time. Now, let's take that example of 2 years. The honest answer is we're not going to get there in 2 years. That's why we have to redouble our efforts. Think about those who are genuinely struggling to pay their bills. I've spoke to customers who've struggled between putting food on the table for their children and heating their homes. That's the group we need to focus on through this transition.
Do you foresee any change to the way that standing charges are calculated anytime soon?
We've laid out today our response to the first round of questions that we asked around the standing charge. And without a doubt, there is a strong message from the public saying they want to see change. So here are the choices. Now, we've laid out some choices in the short term and potentially how we might look at network charges in the long term. The truth is, though, there is no silver bullet. As a regulator, we can't make costs disappear. We can simply make them move from one part of the bill to the other. Now, if you do reduce standing charges, you have to increase what's called the unit rate, the charge per unit that customers pay. That is likely to mean that those families that really depend on energy, those families that have low income but high energy use, for example, families with disabled children, families that rely on electricity only for their heating, their bills go up quite significantly. So we want to have a conversation with government and the sector about how, if we make these changes, the most vulnerable will be protected.
Jonathan Brearley from Ofgem, thank you. Just to recap, the increase is £150 in the annual bill for the typical household in Great Britain. Rachel Maskell, who's the Labour MP for York Central and chair of the All Parliamentary Group on Ageing and Older People, is on the line. How would you like the government to respond to this news today, Rachel?
Good morning. Labour has inherited a very serious problem where we have 2.1 million pensioners in poverty, and that's according to the Joseph Rowntree Foundation poverty report. So being able to protect those individuals is absolutely crucial this winter. We know that this will create a public health emergency, that rise in fuel costs. And last year, the End Fuel Poverty Coalition calculated there was 4,950 people who died because of cold homes. So we've got to protect the most vulnerable people in our society. And therefore, I'm deeply concerned that some of that protection is being removed through the ending of the universal benefit of the winter fuel payment.
What are you therefore calling for to reverse the decision on winter fuel payments?
I really do think government need to review this, and I commend them for trying to move those 880,000 pensioners onto pension credit at breakneck speed. But that is going to be insufficient for protecting those people just above the pension credit threshold. And therefore, I will call on government, first of all, to look at a social tariff. We know that the oil and gas giants made tens of billions of pounds in profit. And when you think that old people are going to be making that consideration of whether or not they put their heating on this winter, it's of deep, deep concern. We know that the government arm's length body has said that the indoor temperature should be kept at 18 degrees Celsius. That's the UK Health Security Agency. So we're nearly at those temperatures now. So we need to ensure we protect the old and the frail. And of course, as you get older, you don't retain your heat as well, and you're more susceptible to respiratory conditions, circulatory disease, and people sadly could end up ill or in our NHS if we don't get this right.
And you want this looked at urgently. You want some kind of change urgently, do you? Because the Cabinet Minister responsible, Ed Miliband, has blamed this picture on failed energy policy and said the only solution to get bills down and greater energy independence is to have clean, homegrown power. And Jonathan Brearley, a moment ago, acknowledged that, but said to us there's going to be no change from that policy to bills in the next 2 years.
Ed Miliband is absolutely correct. Ensuring that we have got good energy security, renewable energy, bring those bills down, is what the last government should have been doing. And I'm pleased that he is pressing ahead at full pace. But of course, we're talking about this winter, and we're talking about a few weeks' time, people making that decision whether or not they can afford to put their heating on. And of course, many people from that generation they're very frightened about the bills that they will receive and whether or not they will be able to pay them. And and local authorities will not have the additional money of the Housing Support Fund, which they had last year, and other benefits are also curtailed. So we need to ensure that we wrap protection around our older people. Yesterday, government put the regulations down to come in on the 16th of September. They are yet to go through the Social Security Advisory Committee to be scrutinised. And of course, in such a tight timeline, I question, will Parliament have the opportunity to fully debate these measures as well? They weren't in the manifesto. And for that reason, I really urge the government to think again about how it's going to protect the most vulnerable people in our society, our pensioners, this winter.
Rachel Maskell, Labour MP, thank you very much.
17 minutes past seven. The deal here in Chicago is done. Kamala Harris formally accepted her party's nomination for the presidency just a few hours ago.
I promise to be a president for all Americans. You can always trust me to put country above party and self, to hold sacred America's fundamental principles, from the rule of law to free and fair elections to the peaceful transfer of power.
Sarah Smith, our North America editor, was watching it all. Did she think Kamala Harris had seized the moment?
I think what she was trying to do very much was to look and sound presidential. And she came across a little bit differently than she has been doing on the campaign trail. There was less of the joyful, sunny optimism that we've had from her that was such a contrast with the way Joe Biden was running his election campaign before he stepped aside. And this was more controlled, more serious, and probably deliberately so, in order to introduce herself to the country, not only just who she is and telling us a little bit more of her backstory, but very much trying to present herself as somebody that they can see as their president, as their commander in chief, and whom they can trust really with the nation. And if that's what she was trying to do, I think it was probably reasonably effective, but it just didn't have the uplifting mood that some of the other speakers at this convention have had and that she's been able to bring to some of her rallies.
Did it get us any closer to knowing what she would do if she became president?
It set the tone, I think. She gave us some broad brush. She says she wants to cut taxes for lower paid people, that she wants to build more homes to make the cost of housing more affordable. There's a big focus on bringing down the cost of prescription drugs and making access to medicine cheaper and easier for people. And a big focus as well on moving the country forward. I think there's quite an effective phrase that they're using a lot in this campaign and that you heard chanted around the hall again and again and again, which is, we are not going back. And that sounds fairly superficial, but it can mean quite a number of things. It means we're not going back to the guy you've had as president before. You know all about him. You know what it was like when he was president. Let's not move back to that. But also, it's supposed to represent the idea that if Donald Trump was re-elected, he would remove some rights from Americans.
And really interesting, Hillary Clinton used to talk a lot when she was running for the presidency about the importance of it being the first woman, potentially, in the White House. Kamala Harris didn't mention it.
Not one word about the fact that she is only ever the second female candidate for a major political party running for president, that if elected, she would be the first woman president. Never mentioned at all in this speech. Very, very rarely mentioned actually at all by her on the campaign. She doesn't have to. I mean, I think it's pretty obvious that she is a female candidate and would be the first woman president, but it's not something that she makes a big deal about.
She mentioned Gaza, didn't she? She specifically mentioned Gaza and Israel, and at slightly more length, I think, than people thought she was going to.
And in a different way than certainly I was expecting her to, and I think most people in the hall, because she emphasised first Israel's right to defend itself and that she would support that if she was the president. She talked about the horror of the October 7th attacks in some detail. She mentioned the need to free all of the Israeli hostages and said that America, certainly if she was the president, would always be behind Israel. She then went on to talk about Gaza, about the suffering there among civilians, which she described as heartbreaking. But the emphasis, I felt, certainly was on Israel, not Palestine. She got a great big cheer when she talked about the need to support Palestinian self-determination as well as to have a ceasefire in Gaza. But she was pretty steadfast in saying that she would essentially run that aspect of foreign policy the same way Joe Biden has been doing.
Sarah Smith, thank you.
22 minutes past seven, a presenter who was seen by many as stepping into Gary Lineker's shoes in Future has had his BBC career come to an abrupt end, sacked amid allegations of inappropriate messages in the workplace. The news about Jermaine Genus, a presenter on The One Show on BBC One and part of the Match of the Day team, came as he was going on air at Talk Sport, where he was asked about it subsequently by their news team.
I can't really talk about it. As you can probably see, I am not happy about it. But currently, as it stands, I'm going to have to let the lawyers deal with it. You know, there's two sides to every story.
It's being reported that you sent unsolicited texts to a female member of staff at The One Show. Is that true?
I'm not happy about this situation. I'm going to be speaking to my lawyers about it, is all I can say right now.
Jermaine Genus yesterday. Charlotte Gallagher, BBC culture correspondent, is here in the studio. What do we know, or what can we say about these allegations, Charlotte?
So we understand that he's been sacked because of allegations about his behaviour in the workplace. And those allegations involve digital communications, so text messages, WhatsApp messages to members of staff. And it's reported that they are members of staff working on The One Show. So that's one of his jobs that he had here at the BBC. He presented Match of the Day and he also presented The One Show. And like you said, he was seen as one of the likely successors to Gary Lineker. He was certainly positioning himself to be the next main host of Match of the Day. But that is obviously not going to happen now.
And the fact that the BBC has not suspended him, has sacked him, mm-hmm. while saying very little on the record about the detail of this, but also already taking his image down from where it appears in posters.
Yeah, there was a big mural outside Key House, which is the main office in Salford where Breakfast is broadcast from, and there was a big picture of him. That's been taken down now. He's essentially been erased from the BBC and no mention is being made of him. Interestingly, The One Show last night when it was broadcast, they made no reference to the fact that one of their presenters, Jermaine Genus, had been sacked. But yeah, he's certainly been deleted, essentially, from the corporation.
And he says he's talking to his lawyers. But do you think the swift nature of this and the action that's been taken is because of the Hugh Edwards scandal?
That's what many people are speculating and thinking, because the corporation was really criticised, wasn't it, for the way some people said it dragged its heels over Hugh Edwards. After he was suspended, he still continued to receive his full pay. Even after he was arrested on suspicion of making indecent images, he received around £200,000 in that period from when he was arrested to when he resigned. And people were angry. Many people were angry that he was allowed to resign. He wasn't sacked and he left on his terms. So some people are suggesting that this swift action over Jermaine Genus is in reaction to the criticism the corporation received over Hugh Edwards.
Charlotte Gallagher, thank you.
25 past seven, a trial to determine the safety of a novel vaccine for lung cancer is going to be taking place at sites across England and Wales. The first patient already receiving the jab at the National Institute for Health Research at UCL. Hospital in London. Let us talk to Professor Xiaoming Li, who is a consultant there and the national lead of the UK arm of this international trial. Professor, good morning to you.
Good morning, everyone.
Tell us what the trial does and who's involved.
Well, we treated the first lung cancer patient with mRNA cancer vaccine, and so we hope to kickstart this new era of mRNA cancer vaccine treatment for our lung cancer population. So the idea is that we target what we call tumor-associated antigen or protein expressed in our lung cancer cells, and hopefully in combination with the current standard treatment, which is mainly immunotherapy and chemotherapy, we hope we can provide additional immune boost to hunt down our cancer cell. So we're very excited
This is for people who already have lung cancer, and it's to prevent it recurring. Is that right? Or is it also in people who don't have lung cancer but are at risk?
Well, at the moment, the patient we treated, he had stage 3 lung cancer. So he just completed a course of radiation and chemotherapy. So we know there is a risk that cancer can come back. So we're adding in this mRNA cancer vaccine alongside the standard immunotherapy treatment. And hopefully we can further improve his chance of the cancer not coming back.
Do you see I mean, this is a safety trial, isn't it?
Correct.
You want other people to get involved. How would they do that if they want to? And what is the timing of this? In other words, when do you expect to have the results and go to the next stage?
Well, we hope, as I said, we want to kickstart this treatment. We hope to roll out eventually to what we call the phase two and phase three treatment. We want to compare that against standard treatment. And the more people participate in the study, we hope to complete the study as soon as possible and move on to what we call a randomized study in the future.
You are excited about it, aren't you? I mean, it's always we always have these conversations with doctors where we're pressing them to say, you know, how quickly can progress come? But it is fair to say, isn't it, that although this is a very early stage, it is potentially a big deal.
Yes, I hope it's a big game changer. Just don't forget, we treated our first, or we used our first COVID vaccine less than 4 years ago. And see the transformation it has made. It saved millions of lives worldwide. And we hope this mRNA cancer technology can be transferred to our cancer population. And don't forget, lung cancer is the most common cancer. It affected 2.5 million patients worldwide, 1.8 million deaths worldwide. And in UK alone, our survival is still less than 1 year overall for lung cancer population. So I hope, we hope this vaccine, you know, can improve the lives of many more of our patients worldwide.
Professor Xiaoming Li from University College Hospital London, thank you very much.
The Sport Now with Gary.
Good morning to you. Let's mark your card for the sporting day ahead. First, the weather in Manchester, where England are playing Sri Lanka in the Test match. There's likely to be rain early on, but the forecast from midday is encouraging. England will resume on 259 for six. That's 23 runs ahead. Jamie Smith is 72 not out. So what's in store today? A question for Jonathan Agnew.
An intriguing and unpredictable day is in store, one that could determine the fate of this Test match. If England start well and Smith continues his fluent innings, England will post a lead that could overwhelm the Sri Lankans in the notoriously difficult third innings. However, if Sri Lanka can restrict England to a manageable lead and knuckle down with a bat, they have the chance to make things very difficult in the fourth innings on a wearing pitch. And that was evident yesterday in two deliveries from Jayasuriya that spun very sharply. Brook was stunned by the first, which took his off stump for 56, and Wokes could only nod in appreciation when he was also bowled by the left armour for 25. Smith has played beautifully once again. He really has taken a Test cricket very quickly, and he will have his first century in his sights.
Test match special starts at 10. One other interesting cricket line to pass on. Andrew Flintoff's son, Rocky, made his debut in the county championship for Lancashire, and he scored 32. Lancashire, though, were dismissed for 204, Surrey 83 without loss. So you know about the weather in Manchester. What's it like in St Andrews this morning? Second round of the Women's Open Golf Championship started at 7. England's Charlie Hull had an excellent first round. Correspondent Ian Carter sets the scene. Good morning to you, Ian.
Morning, Gary. Well, the fierce winds of yesterday, they've subsided. That's the good news. The bad news, it's raining, and it's raining pretty heavy at the moment. So not ideal, but for the early starters, and Charlie Hull is among them, these softer conditions and lower winds are potentially conducive to low scoring. It was a brilliant performance yesterday from Hull, a 5-under par, 67, capped off with a birdie at the last, and she has the outright lead by a single shot. And by a distance, Gary, this was Hull's best start to a tournament this year, one ahead of playing partner Nelly Korda and Ronnie Yin of China.
And other British players have been doing well.
Yes, I walked all 18 holes yesterday in the fiercest of the conditions with Georgia Hall, and the Dorset golfer who won this event in 2019 had a real battle on her hands, but she came through it. An eagle at the ninth, her last hole, that was sensational. A 1-under par 71, and that was an outstanding score in those conditions. And the British amateur Lottie Woad was out at the same time. Her level par 72 has her in contention, likewise Bronte Law, but it really is Charlie Hull who's the most exciting prospect after that fantastic 67 yesterday.
More with Ian in an hour, and there's commentary right now on Sports Extra. Well, Chelsea were booed off the pitch at half-time, but they did win their Europa Conference tie 2-0 against Servette. In their European ties, Kilmarnock lost 2-0 and Hearts were beaten 1-0, conceding in the 96th minute, but both teams have home ties to come. What's it like to be a football manager? Well, in an hour, I'll be speaking to Howard Wilkinson. He's just stood down as the chairman of the League Managers Association.
My father left school when he was 14 on a Tuesday and he was down the pit on a Wednesday. And he made sure, as I was growing up, he kept reminding me that I was not going to work down the pit.
Howard in an hour. Another good day of racing at York. It's the second day of the E-ball meeting. Our tips, 225, number 5, Quickthorn, 335, number 9, Adfora.
Gary, thank you. As we have been hearing, there is rain, but it is going to clear to the east, leaving sunny spells for most. It'll be windy for a start off in southern and central areas, breezy further north. You are listening to Today on Radio 4. Michelle Hussain in London, Justin Webb in Chicago. The time is 28 minutes to 8. Let's hear from Jane Steele with the news.
Ofgem has announced that the energy price cap will increase by 10% from the 1st of October. It means a typical household bill in England, Scotland and Wales will rise by around £150 a year. Campaigners have raised concerns that many pensioners could struggle to pay their bills over the next few months following the withdrawal of winter fuel payments for 10 million households. Kamala Harris has formally accepted her nomination as the Democratic candidate for president at her party's national convention. Speaking in Chicago, the vice president promised a new way forward for the United States and warned that the consequences would be extremely serious if Donald Trump was returned to the White House in November. Jermaine Genus, who presented The One Show and appeared on Match of the Day, has said there are two sides to every story after he was sacked by the BBC. It's understood there were complaints about his workplace conduct. The former footballer said he wasn't happy about the dismissal and that he was speaking to lawyers. The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has rejected accusations from the Conservative Party that the government is caving to unions following moves to end strikes involving public sector workers, junior doctors and train drivers. Ms. Reeves has insisted there are no blank cheques to deal with pay disputes. The government says it is determined to take action against websites which encourage suicide. It follows a BBC investigation into a forum where more than 700 British people have advertised for a partner to die with. Predatory men were also found to have used the forum to target vulnerable women. India's Prime Minister Narendra Modi has arrived in Ukraine for a visit in which he says he wants to share perspectives on a peaceful resolution of the war with Russia. His trip comes just weeks after he met the Russian President Vladimir Putin in Moscow and hugged him. Mr. Modi has refused to condemn Russia's full-scale invasion of Ukraine.
Thank you, Jane. It's just coming up to 25 to 8. One of the things that shocks Americans about the campaign now for the White House is how brief it is. Normally, of course, two candidates slug it out for months. There are only days now, though, until early voting begins in several states. So what, as the Democrats leave Chicago today, is the state of the race? Tom Perez is President Biden's senior advisor on intergovernmental affairs. He's a former Labor secretary under Barack Obama and head of the Democratic National Committee.
Well, the state of the race is that Vice President Harris and Governor Walz have a lot of wind at their sails. You know, there's a lot of momentum. People are excited. It manifests itself in so many ways. You look at small dollar donations. That's a very big bellwether as someone who used to run the party that has exploded. And by the way, first-time donors as well. And people are hungry for the end of the divisive politics. What Kamala Harris and Tim Walz bring to the table is they're happy warriors. They want to build an America where it's not I succeed only if you fail. That's the zero-sum us against them kind of politics. They are about making sure that wherever you live, you can enjoy and earn and benefit from these investments, the American dream. Now, let me also be clear. We come out of this with momentum, but we still have a long time. And as the vice president herself has said, this is going to be close. And so it's important to have this momentum. And it's exciting, but it's not the end of the election. I have been through a few elections, and it's we've got a long time to go, and we're going to keep organizing everywhere. And the Harris-Walz team inherits a strong infrastructure and now has the resources to fortify that.
She stood for the candidacy in 2019 and it didn't go well. How confident are you that she is a different kind of candidate now?
Well, watch the last month and you've seen, I think, her nearly flawless reintroduction to the American people. Remember, put Barack Obama aside. Barack Obama is on so many levels a unicorn. Okay, so let's put that aside for the moment. You know, our American history, especially of recent vintage, the rule is that you run more than once before you win. I mean, Ronald Reagan, George Herbert Walker Bush, Richard Nixon. And so the question is always, what do you learn from that? And I think the vice president has learned an immense amount.
What do you think she has learned?
I think she's relentlessly optimistic. She has a really good team in place. She is articulating her vision of America. She is not allowing efforts to distract by the other side to throw her off her game. He does this otherism all the time. That's what I call it. You know, no, Barack Obama's not one of you. You know, I don't think he was born here. You know, and then the mispronunciation of her name, same stuff. She's not talking about that. She's not stooping to that level. And so her relentless focus is on, how do I reduce the cost of groceries? And we're going to go after these grocery companies that are profiteering right now. How do I further reduce the cost of healthcare? We've made great progress, but we still got too many people paying too much. How do we make sure that, you know, when you go to school in the morning or when you send your kid off to school, you don't have to have a pit in your stomach about whether they're going to get shot that day because there's a mass shooting. She's focusing on issues that keep people up at night, and she's articulating a vision that's future-looking.
The party has tried before to get a woman elected president and failed. Have things changed this time round sufficiently, I suppose, in the country, mm-hmm. or does it not matter?
Well, you know, the journey to progress is a journey that is often long. Shirley Chisholm ran for president, I believe, in 1972 and didn't make it to the mountaintop, but her journey up the mountain was a big part of what inspired Jesse Jackson to run. He didn't make it to the mountaintop, but his journey was a message to America that we're getting up there. And then Barack Obama came, and he was able to get to the mountaintop. You know, similarly, you know, we've had women, as I just mentioned, Shirley Chisholm and Kamala Harris. And I think there's a very different moment in time we're in right now. With every passing year in this country, we become more and more diverse. There's so many people across this country. It's the norm. And we're living in a community now as we move forward where people understand that, you know, in the workplace, diversity and inclusion is not philanthropy. It's about the bottom line if you want to succeed. And Kamala Harris, I think, embodies so much of what America has become, a nation of immigrants who are succeeding, women increasingly moving to higher levels. And the contrast, and you have to understand that elections are about contrast. People had 4 years of history with Donald Trump. And if you look at focus groups, after he got elected, focus groups, for instance, of white college-educated women, the majority of white college-educated women in 2016 voted for Donald Trump. And the focus group asked the following question: are you afraid that he's going to do away with a woman's right to choose and overturn Roe versus Wade? And the basic answer was, oh, he has a lot of bluster, but he won't follow through. People know to take him at his word. When he says, I will be a dictator on day one, people understand it. When he says, you won't have to vote again in 4 years, people understand what he means. They take him at his word now in a way they didn't. So we have the benefit of a candidate and a ticket who exudes optimism, who wants to bring America together and has a proven track record, whether it's in Minnesota or nationally, of doing it. And we have the contrast now of Donald Trump's history. And then we have the overlay of the increasing, changing face of America. I think it's really exciting. And that's why you see so much excitement here.
Tom Perez, thank you very much for sparing the time to talk to us.
My pleasure.
And back here at just after 20 to 8, we are looking ahead to a bank holiday weekend. And the August bank holiday weekend is a bumper one for festivals. Among the hundreds of events taking place, one is trying to change the way we do outdoor music forever. When Massive Attack perform on Sunday for 34,000 fans in their hometown of Bristol, they're aiming to do it without diesel generators, without mountains of rubbish, and without the use of cars. David Sillito reports.
Massive Attack, Bristol's superstars of trip-hop. 5 years after they last played their hometown, Rob Del Naya and Daddy G are back with something that's more than a concert, but a whole new approach to festivals. No cars, no diesel, no rubbish.
It's a first. It's an experiment, and we're just quite excited. It's a big deal for us.
You're making it special.
I think the nature of this production makes it special, yeah.
And it begins with transport. We and the fans were asked to come by train. But the train only gets you so far. Then you have to get to the gig.
You could walk, but it's quite a trek, and almost all of it uphill. Or you could try cycling. I said, try.
However, there is an alternative that's rather easier on your legs than the long walk or cycle up the hill. A bus. An electric bus. Okay if I sit anywhere?
I've
got the bus to myself. On site, it's like a green laboratory. A battery-powered green laboratory. Dale Vince knows festivals well. In the 80s, he was what used to be called a New Age traveller. He's now a renewable energy tycoon.
It is a first. An event this size with this many people being entirely powered by batteries without a drop of diesel.
But why can't you just plug it into the mains?
Great question, because there's no mains
there's
here.
No mains.
And that's the fundamental problem of outdoor events. They run on diesel. 12 million litres of diesel burnt annually in our country to power outdoor events. 12 million litres.
But this is about more than just cars and power, as I found out in the tea tent. Where are the cups?
There aren't any cups here. You need to bring your own.
I haven't got a cup. I haven't brought a cup.
It's a waste-free zone. You're supposed to bring your own cup. Don't worry.
Most festivals end up being a sea of rubbish. Here, Claire and Eloise are leading the war on waste.
This is going to be composted.
So this stuff that's normally thrown on the ground, you can just put it in the compost heap?
You can.
Are you monitoring everything that comes onto the site then?
Yeah. Yeah. Every part of the site has to be...
You're like camp commandant here, making sure everything is green. Even the liquid waste is being recycled, and collecting it from the female fans is, they say, going to bring about a bit of gender justice.
What are we looking at here?
They are squatting urinals.
For
women and non-binary people.
Why?
To rebalance the urinal queues.
This is social justice.
Yeah. Absolutely. We're trying to collect all of the urine to use as a trial for phosphate in farming in the southwest. And it also just reduces the toilet queues and makes everyone much happier.
For the band, this is a passion project.
This is just something that we love doing. It's our bit to help, really.
The only time you'll know it's really worked is when you walk on stage in front of 34,000 people and the actual lights come on and the music works properly.
I think the only time we know it's worked is when we walk off stage and there's been no power cuts in between. As we bow off stage, lights down, great, no interruptions.
Are you worried?
No, I mean, to be honest, this experiment's been 5 years in the making and the technical sort of like work that's gone into it, it's phenomenal, really.
And after that, it's time for me to cycle back. It is, essentially, a bit of an experiment, and it does prove one thing, quite how much thought has to go into trying to convince people to not use their cars. But if you do come by bike, at least it's downhill all the way. Oh, I hope these brakes are good. This is steeper than I thought.
David Sillito reporting for us. It brings us to 40 minutes to 8, time for Thought for the Day. The speaker this morning, Jasveer Singh from the Faiths Forum for London.
Good morning. The August bank holiday weekend is nearly upon us, and for many people, one of the highlights is the Notting Hill Carnival. I remember the first time I went was when I was a teenager. The floats, the outfits, the music, the food. It was a real feast for all of the senses, and it was a wonderful experience of the British Caribbean community. The fact that I was there with my school friends made it all the more enjoyable, and in fact, one of those friends now plays in a steel band in the parade. The story of how the Notting Hill Carnival came to be celebrated in the first place is a timely one. Late August in 1958 saw race riots in Notting Hill over the course of a fortnight, with black residents being the target of white youths, and black youths arming themselves to retaliate. There was also a similar but much shorter riot in Nottingham. In the aftermath, a Trinidadian journalist by the name of Claudia Jones wanted to, in the words of one of her contemporaries, wash the taste of Notting Hill and Nottingham out of our mouths. Her solution was an indoor Caribbean carnival just 6 months later, which ended up being televised on the BBC, and some of the money raised went towards paying the court fines of the young people caught up on both sides of the rioting. She had found a unique way to bring people together in celebration and to bridge the divisions highlighted by the riots. That festival was the first of many others in the local area, and they later developed into the Notting Hill Carnival we know today. We're still coming to terms with what the riots this summer mean for us as a nation, and as for the longer impact, only time will tell. However, even in darkness, there is always a source of light. Carnivals are opportunities for us to celebrate and rejoice, and to express ourselves as we want to. It's a chance to reclaim the public space from feelings of fear and hatred, and replace those emotions with love and happiness. When sending invitations for joyful occasions, Sikhs will often include the phrase, "There are hundreds of thousands of pleasures and happinesses if the true Guru bestows their gracious glance." It's the idea that all celebrations are a blessing from the divine, and that we should acknowledge the Almighty for allowing us the opportunity to be joyful. This summer has been a tough one for many people, and there is still a huge amount to do to rebuild communities across the country. However, for those of us who can, let's take this bank holiday weekend to unwind, relax, and perhaps even enjoy the many delights of a street festival.
And that was Thought for the Day with Jasveer Singh. Brings us to just coming up to 10 to 8.
Mental health care for those with serious psychiatric problems has been in a new and harsh spotlight in recent days since we learnt from a report of serious errors, omissions and misjudgments over Valdo Kallikane, the man who had been noted as capable of possibly killing someone and who did then stab three people to death in Nottingham last year. One of them was Ian Coates, and James Coates, his son, spoke to us last week.
Every patient has their own rights as well, but when you've got a patient that's not understanding what's going on with them, like Kallikane was, or he was lying about how he was feeling, he was masking his symptoms, refusing his medication, if they're known that they're violent and there could be a chance that they could go out and attack or kill, then there has to be more authority for the police and the mental health trust to be able to do something extra.
Well, Claire Murdoch, who is NHS England's mental health director, is here in the studio with us. Morning, Claire. Welcome. What would you say to someone who's heard about the Valdo Kallikane case and who is genuinely frightened by it and thinks that perhaps the whole system is in crisis and can't cope with people like this?
Yes, look, the Valdo Kallikane case was gut-wrenching, and obviously our heart goes out to those families and all other families who may have been in a similar situation. What I would say, though, is that we all have mental health, and one in four people at different times in their life will have a common mental health problem for which they will need treatment, and we encourage them to come forward. We see 4.5 million people a year in mental health services, a million more than we did even a few short years ago. And a tiny percentage of those people have a severe psychosis such as Valdo Kallikane, a diagnosis of paranoid schizophrenia. And what I would say to people is that every day, clinicians across this country, well-trained, understand many of the symptoms and behaviours of people who do need assertive outreach, who do need to take their medication, who do need to engage with services. And when they're not, it's really important that those services are actively and assertively outreaching to them.
But they weren't
their GP
enough,
and their family.
Were they, in the case of Valdo Calacane? I wonder what you think the lessons are to learn. How unusual is it for someone's notes to say, this man could kill someone?
I think that's quite unusual, but what won't be unusual is for mental health services to be actively assessing the risk that this small number of very poorly, very ill, very unwell, often uninsightful when they're unwell, people have. Clinicians are making decisions all day, every day, within a legal framework that does allow them, for example, to put people on community treatment orders. Currently there are 4,700 people on community treatment orders in the country today.
Do you mind
today?
Just explaining for a moment what those are?
Yes.
Does that mean that medication has to be taken or has to be taken in the course of an appointment in front of a medical practitioner?
If you're on a community treatment order, it means that you've got a serious illness, like Valdo Calacane. You may have been admitted under a section of the Mental Health Act several times. He was admitted four times under a Mental Health Act in the 2 years before this catastrophic incident. And it means that the community team and the hospital team can discharge you on something that's a legal framework called a community treatment order. And that can specify certain things you must do if you're to live and recover in the community with the support of your family and loved ones, specialists. And that does include, for example, the CQC pointed this out, but clinicians think about this every day with such patients, whether you should have a depot medication, for example. That's an injection that is given once a fortnight or once a month. You know the patient's had that, or you can ask patients to take their medication in front of you. The role of drugs and other therapies and engagement with your community team is a really important thing for this small number of patients, and we have got legal frameworks that we can use.
But that didn't happen in this case. Why didn't it happen? And it's not the only case involving this particular trust. In fact, we spoke to a woman whose son killed her father, the woman's father, and he was treated by the same trust.
What we've done with the trust is it's now in our highest level of both oversight and improvement support, the highest level that the NHS has. That means there's a very detailed action plan in place. There are people in the trust working with them and alongside them, ensuring that they're making improvements. And the region that the trust is in is also actively engaged with that trust. I speak to the chief executive of that trust regularly. They've made all kinds of improvements already, such as they have refreshed and really trained on what their assertive outreach policy is about, not discharging such patients back to the care of GPs without seeing them and making sure they're getting the treatment they need. There are all kinds of other improvements they are making. But I guess as national director, what's important to me, and I think to the public and to professionals across the country and families, is that we're taking action across the country. So, for example, my team nationally have worked with a whole range of people, experts, lived experience, to refresh the guidance to all systems and trusts across the country on assertive outreach. And what we've done is ask all systems to, by the end of September — we asked for this back in March, we've given them 6 months to look at this — everywhere across the country is currently reviewing what their arrangements are for these patients.
Yeah, but does that guidance — I'm just wondering if that guidance is that you would like to see practitioners go further towards the depot injections, physically giving someone their medication through an injection in a way that you know is going to last for 2 weeks?
I'm a registered mental health nurse still, and I began my training 40 years ago, actually, in the days of the Victorian asylums and closure, where people were incarcerated, often for life. I looked after people in their 70s and 80s who'd been admitted when they were 15 and been in hospital all their lives. And there was a lot of coercive treatment. And of course, we ended that era of coercive treatment. What we know, and there's a big evidence base for this, the researchers and academics will tell us this as well, is that building rapport and knowledge with such patients as Valdo and their families and their social worker and others to try and actually get consensus about what your treatment plan should be is the most effective and safest way of treating such people in the community. And this compulsion and the legal framework is absolutely there, and we've updated, you know, what does good look like, what is good quality care, what are the clinical standards that we need to see across the country.
Quite labour intensive, isn't it, to have that kind of dedication to try and reach people who are going to be very, very hard to reach. Someone like this man was very hard to reach. Do you have enough staff to do that, or are resources part of the problem here?
Well, one of the things that will happen is across the country in September, the integrated care boards that are looking at their arrangements and what care is in place for such patients at my instigation will actually discuss in public the services they've got, how they're working and what their action plan is to make sure they can reach people. I am every day concerned about the pressure that mental health services are under. I think our waiting lists, we have 1.5 million people on an NHS waiting list, are too long. We worry about people accessing care in a timely way. We're rolling out and trialling 6 new neighbourhood mental health centres across the country currently, which are going to have 24 open access, no appointments needed, come in, see a professional, get advice, get support. But in addition, I do want to say in recent years, we've had a dedicated ring fence financially. We've employed 43,000 more mental health staff. Yeah. We're seeing 1 million more patients. And it's my determination and my promise and that of Amanda Pritchard, our chief exec, and the whole NHS England board to do all in our power to work flat out to reach more people.
Claire Murdoch from NHS England, thank you.
A couple of minutes to wait to Darren Benton, the weather.
Thank you. Unseasonably windy weather this morning due to Storm Lillian. The worst of the weather will be this morning. It's going to be particularly windy across England and Wales. The winds are picking up in northern England, widely 50, 60 mile an hour gusts, possibly even higher than that. Heavy rain is moving across Scotland, but by mid to late morning, the rain should have cleared. The winds will be starting to ease down, and the rest of the day we'll see some sunshine. We'll also see some blustery showers, mainly across Scotland and Northern Ireland, with temperatures 16 or 17 degrees here. A bit warmer for England and Wales. 23 in the southeast.
Darren, thank you very much. You're listening to Today. Sorry, I got to that too early. I decided it was the top of the hour when it wasn't. Let us turn to what is coming up on Radio 4.
Hello, good morning. Alex Forsyth here. And tonight we're in New Earswick, a village on the outskirts of York, for any questions. And with news of the energy price cap, we have the Labour MP and former Shadow Energy Secretary, Barry Gardner, on our panel. Joining him will be the Conservative Shadow State for Business and Trade, Kevin Hollenrake, the Liberal Democrat spokesperson for Work and Pensions, Wendy Chamberlain. And we also have the co-chair of the National Care Association, Nadra Ahmed. We will be live at 8 p.m. as ever. I do hope you can join us.
Thank you very much, Alex. And coming up in the next hour of the programme, we will be looking ahead to the start of the Paralympics and particularly talking about why better prosthetic limbs are needed.
You're listening to Today on Radio 4, Michelle Hussain and Justin Webb. The 23rd of August. The headlines this morning. The energy price cap is to go up by 10% in October, sparking concern about vulnerable households and pensioners who are losing their winter fuel allowance. Kamala Harris has accepted the Democratic Party's presidential nomination, urging US voters to choose freedom and dignity instead of bitterness and division. And the sacked BBC presenter, Jermaine Genus, has said there are two sides to every story. The BBC News is read this morning by Jane Steele.
The energy regulator Ofgem has announced that its price cap will rise by 10% in October. It means the annual gas and electricity bill for a typical household in England, Scotland and Wales will increase to just over £1,700. The Energy Secretary Ed Miliband said the prospect of that would deeply worry many families and blamed what he called the failed energy policy of the previous government. Here's our cost of living correspondent Coletta Smith.
28 million households will see their energy bills increase from the 1st of October. A typical bill will go up by £149 to £1,717 a year. Although, of course, if you use more energy, you'll pay more than that because the cap limits the price per unit of gas or electricity. The head of Ofgem, Jonathan Brearley, told this programme the reason for the rise is that our system is dependent on fluctuating international oil and gas prices.
This situation of volatile gas prices being certainly higher than they were pre-crisis is one that's likely to be around for a long time. Now, I always say it's a fool that predicts the gas price, so I don't know that's the case, but I think government, Ofgem, the sector and consumer groups need to see this as a long-term, not a short-term problem.
Although prices will be fractionally lower than last autumn and winter, significant numbers of people will find these bills harder to manage. That's because there are no more cost of living payments being given to those on benefits, and the winter fuel payment has been removed for the vast majority of pensioners by the new government. Those on pension credit will still receive the payment, but around 10 million other pensioners will find their bills going up in October at the same moment the £300 winter fuel payment is withdrawn.
Kamala Harris has delivered her pitch to be the next US president, promising a new way forward. Addressing the last night of the Democratic Party convention in Chicago, Ms. Harris said she would be a leader for all Americans, and she warned that the consequences would be extremely serious if Donald Trump was returned to the White House in November's election. Our North America editor, Sarah Smith, was among the crowds listening in Chicago.
Kamala Harris had a lot to achieve with one 40-minute speech, introducing herself to Americans who don't know that much about her, explaining what she will do if she gets elected, and most importantly, looking and sounding like a president. She said this election was an opportunity for America to move beyond bitterness and division and chart a new way forward.
I promise to be a president for all Americans. You can all.
Ms. Harris said she wanted to build a country in which everyone had the chance to succeed, accusing Donald Trump of being interested only in himself and his rich friends, and saying this election is also about the future of American democracy.
Donald Trump is an unserious man. But the consequences of putting Donald Trump back in the White House are extremely serious.
Kamala Harris has been running a sunny, optimistic campaign. This speech was less uplifting, more serious and sober, warning that Donald Trump would take the country backwards and hoping that voters will see her as the candidate of the future.
The television presenter and football pundit Jermaine Genus has said he is consulting his lawyers after being sacked by the BBC. He was dismissed following allegations of inappropriate behaviour. The former footballer, who presented The One Show and regularly appeared on Match of the Day, has been taken off air with immediate effect. Here's our culture reporter Noor Nanji.
Jermaine Genus said there were two sides to every story after he was sacked by the BBC following complaints about workplace conduct. Speaking to TalkSport Radio, he said he was going to let his lawyers deal with the situation. He declined to give any further details of the allegations against him or to say whether his career would continue after he was taken off air at two primetime shows, Match of the Day and The One Show. BBC News understands that the former footballer's contract was terminated earlier this week because of allegations relating to workplace behaviour, after issues involving digital communications such as texts were raised with the corporation a few weeks ago. Jermaine Genus also works for TalkSport, but the radio station has said he won't be presenting there again in the immediate future.
The Chancellor, Rachel Reeves, has insisted that there are no blank cheques to deal with pay disputes. She was responding to criticism of government moves to end strikes involving public sector workers, junior doctors and train drivers. The Conservatives said ministers had caved to unions, but in an interview with The Guardian, Ms. Reeves dismissed the accusation. More details from our political correspondent Nick Hurdley.
The government says it wants to end disputes to prevent further economic damage, but offering train drivers an unconditional, backdated pay deal led to criticism that the new government was giving away too much too early. And some union leaders have made it clear that higher pay deals for some will likely mean higher demands from others. Rachel Reeves is now seeking to quash suggestions that Labour will be an easy negotiating partner. She told The Guardian Labour had not caved into demands, that she and the Prime Minister set policy, not unions, and that there would be no blank cheques.
Israeli and US negotiators are reported to have started a new round of meetings in Cairo discussing a Gaza ceasefire that would involve the release of hostages held by Hamas. Disagreements about Israel's future military presence in the Strip have emerged as a main obstacle to the deal. From Jerusalem, here's our Middle East correspondent Jalan Nell.
While US officials maintain that a Gaza ceasefire agreement is now in sight, the chances that it will be reached still look slim. Israel demands to keep troops deployed in Gaza along the Netzarim corridor, which cuts the territory in half, and in a buffer zone between Gaza and Egypt, which it calls the Philadelphia corridor. Hamas insists on a full withdrawal of Israeli forces, and Egypt, one of the countries mediating, also wants them removed from its border. While Israel says Hamas has used this area to bring in weapons, Egypt says it's shut off smuggling routes. Last night, the Israeli Prime Minister's office ruled out reports of one possible compromise, stationing a multinational force on the border.
A new vaccine which primes the immune system to recognise and fight lung cancer is being tested for the first time on patients in the UK. It's designed to work in a similar way to many COVID-19 vaccines. 20 patients in Britain are expected to take part in the trial. Professor Xiaoming Li is a consultant medical oncologist at University College London Hospital Trust and the clinical lead for the UK part of the study. He told us he was hopeful the treatment would be a game changer.
Lung cancer is the most common cancer. It affected 2.5 million patients worldwide, 1.8 million deaths worldwide. And in UK alone, our survival is still less than 1 year overall for lung cancer population. So we hope this vaccine, you know, can improve the lives of many more of our patients worldwide.
The funeral for the third victim of last month's stabbings in Southport is being held this morning. Elsie Dot Stancombe, who was seven, was killed during the attack at a Taylor Swift-themed dance class. The girl's family have asked for the service at St John's Church in Birkdale to be called Elsie's Special Day. A BBC investigation has discovered that a Chinese syndicate has been running a multi-million pound investment scam from a hotel and former bank offices on the Isle of Man. Experts have said this is the first case they've seen of such an operation setting up in a Western country. Here's Anka Shah from our Global China unit.
The type of deception the scammers were using is referred to as pig butchering, when they take time to gain a victim's trust or to fatten them up before they strike. They would then convince their target to put money into investment platforms they controlled. The scamming company relocated almost 100 people from Southeast Asia to work on the Isle of Man. Six members of the group who returned to China have now been found guilty of scamming by a Chinese court. A police investigation on the Isle of Man into the companies involved is ongoing. Those involved have not replied to our repeated requests for comment.
The band Massive Attack are to play their first concert in their home city of Bristol since 2019 this weekend, with an event they've tried to make as environmentally friendly as possible. 34,000 fans on Clifton Downs will see a concert powered solely by batteries. Our arts correspondent David Silito reports.
There's no parking, instead a fleet of free electric shuttle buses and a request of fans to make the journey to Bristol by train. The food is vegan, the packaging compostable, and rather than diesel generators, everything runs on batteries powered by electricity from wind and solar. For Rob Del Nair of Massive Attack, after years of talking about the climate, they wanted to prove the music industry could actually do things differently.
It's a frustrating sector to work with sometimes. So this is hopefully going to sort of like create some activity, because it's a sector which has a lot to say about climate change, but unfortunately is not doing much about it.
It is an experiment, and the band says if fans go home without noticing any real difference, that will for them be success.
David Silito reporting.
Thank you. 8:10 is the time. It is 73 days until America goes to the polls. The campaign is going to be vicious, even primal. Donald Trump feels himself to be cornered and unfairly treated. Kamala Harris annoys him a lot. So does what he sees as the fawning coverage in much of the broadcast media. The truth is that most Americans have already made up their minds, but some might be persuaded to vote rather than staying at home. And perhaps a very few might be persuaded to change their minds. Kamala Harris used last night to suggest that she was the scrappy underdog.
We were underestimated at practically every turn. But we never gave up, because the future is always worth fighting for.
a fight for America's future.
In a moment, the great chronicler of American political campaigns, John Heilerman, on her chances now. But first, she is a woman, but she did not mention that fact in her speech. She didn't play up the history that would be made by her victory. And that contrasts with Hillary Clinton's campaign in 2016. Her strategist then was Amanda Renteria.
At the time, it just felt like you were kind of watching a movie that you could see happening.
Tonight, we've reached a milestone in our nation's march toward a more perfect union. The first time that a major party has nominated a woman for president.
We said it often. The Supreme Court is on the ballot, right? Women's rights aren't just guaranteed. You really have to fight for them. And so I felt during that period of time that we were giving so many warnings about why it was so important, particularly for young girls, to get involved and engaged. And what was odd for me at the time was people just didn't believe things would go back. I mean, if you think about it at the moment, right, women were on the rise. People were getting onto boardrooms and CEOs, and you would see pictures of that going into management. So it didn't seem like it could reverse. And unfortunately, it did reverse. But at the time, people were so certain they would see a woman in their lifetime that there's no way Roe v. Wade would ever get turned back around. You know, it was just a different time.
What now then? Different times, a different woman. And according to Amy Parnes, who wrote a book about the Clinton disaster and works now for The Hill newspaper, a different approach from Kamala Harris.
Everyone knows that she's the first of many things, but she's not leaning into it. She's kind of taking the opposite approach as Clinton.
Wisely.
Wisely, because I think when you looked at the autopsy of Hillary Clinton's campaign, I think a lot of people felt like that was the wrong play and the wrong tack. And I think she was advised not to do that. And you're not hearing her talk, and you're not hearing her surrogates talk so much about this moment and how she can do it. They're saying it's for the people instead of for her.
Because however much you might, you know, not appreciate toxic masculinity and all the rest of it, there are a lot of men in America, aren't there? And it feels like a problem almost for the Democratic Party that it's quite easy for them to put them off. And indeed, if you look at the polls, there is a gap that people sort of talk about, whoa, there's a huge gender gap when it comes to men and women supporting the Democratic Party, almost as if it's a good thing, but it's not, is it?
No, and especially when you see, we're at the convention, Kamala Harris has been able to lock down and excite the base, but when you look at who she needs still to win this election, it's really white men, white, blue-collar, non-educated, non-college-educated men. And I think that they're a little bit turned off by that. And so I don't think she wants to do that. And that's intentional.
But there is a pushback to the soft peddling of the historic nature of the Kamala Harris campaign. There are women in the Democratic Party who are not going to be muted in their joy for the sake of politics. It's a debate that has been very live, as I heard from Holly Vidula and Kate Ahern, two young Democrats excited by the moment. Kate spoke first.
I think that would be a tremendous mistake. America constantly views itself as being, you know, a leader of the free world. And when you compare us to our Democratic peers, other nation states, we are so far behind when it comes to the equality we see between the two sexes, right? Having office, having this highest office. We've seen such rampant sexism with our female candidates and the way that people talk about them. There's this idea that it does not matter what her qualifications are. It does not matter how capable, how intelligent, how much of a strong, good leader she is. But the fact that she is a woman would somehow make her a weaker candidate. And to not take a firm, hard stance and come out positively and strongly as America's first female president, which is long overdue, is going to alienate young female voters like us.
Okay, I'll put the same thing to you then, Holly.
You know, end of the day, policy is what really matters, and we're not just voting for her because she's a woman, but we're voting for her because she's a good leader that will represent the best interests of American values and people on the national stage and in the White House. But additionally, it is really important for us to take a moment to pause and celebrate this moment, because the fact that we have a woman of color on the presidential ticket is huge. I actually see myself at Kamala Harris a lot because she has the South Asian heritage that I do too. And I think seeing that representation is going to really resonate with a lot of young women, especially girls like me, and even younger girls, when they look up and see that they're being represented on the biggest stage on international politics.
Kate, you're nodding at that.
Absolutely. To have a female candidate for young Gen Z voters, especially women, is going to be finally some sort of positive history that's happening within our lifetimes. It's monumental.
That was Kate Ahern and Holly Vidula, and so did John Heilerman, whose book Game Change about the 2008 campaign set him on a course to be one of those few American journalists that people on both sides talk to. He's been talking to me about Kamala Harris's chances.
I think with Harris, there is this theory that there have been a handful of movement candidates in our modern time. One of them was Ronald Reagan, another was Barack Obama, and another was Donald Trump, and that Harris at this moment is not quite a movement candidate, but could be. And the we're seeing this, the level of enthusiasm for her is very, very high. Most candidates don't have a chance to get that lightning in a bottle.
What, though, might prevent her becoming a movement candidate, or indeed a winner of any kind, surely, is her connection to a very unpopular president.
Look, I think that she so far has been able to not get really inextricably conjoined with the most unpopular elements of Biden's policy agenda and his record. The one where she's most vulnerable is on immigration, because it's clear that she has a role there. You know, immigration is a problem for Democrats. They know that's a vulnerability for her. Because of the fact that most people in the country don't really know what she did as vice president. And I'll tell you, here's the secret. Vice presidents don't do anything. They hang around a broom closet. Mostly you sit around and do ceremonial things and sometimes get stuck with very unpopular assignments. In her case, she got stuck with one assignment that transformed her political standing in a positive way, which was being the person who was the point person on abortion. And the immigration thing is the example of a thing that has dragged her down. Does she get stuck with a Biden economy? Not clear to me that they can make that stick. And we can talk about whether Donald Trump or the Republicans can make anything stick to her if they continue to run the ridiculously bad, flailing, all over the place. They're not running a campaign against her. They're running 13 campaigns against her, and you can't win that way. But I think that the things that are most, that she's most vulnerable on, is she at some point is going to have to explain how the issue positions that she took in 2020 when she ran for president on a wide variety of issues when she was trying to get to the left in the Democratic primary, because she thought that was the ticket to ride. Turned out to not be, as Joe Biden proved, that actually being the moderate candidate was the way to win in 2020. But she lunged to the left on a wide variety of issues. They're super unpopular on things related to crime, on things related to immigration, on things related to economics, on healthcare, on everything. Took a wide variety of super unpopular positions. Can the Trump campaign make those issues stick with her, or can she's renounced almost all of them? And the standard playbook would be you call her a flip-flopper and say, you believe this, now you believe this. And she ends up having to say, first you start with, these issues are all way too liberal. She ends up running away from them. Now she's a flip-flopper. Flip-flopping is a problem if you can't explain it. And the reason it's a problem is because it goes to the core of who you are. Well, because the question then becomes, are you just taking these positions for expedience? And then you get to the question of phony and inauthentic. So the question is going to be, A, can they make those issues, can they drive those issues in a successful way? And what's her explanation going to be?
Final thought about Trump. You mentioned earlier, his campaign has been all over the place when it comes to opposing, and that's certainly the case. That is widely believed to be true. And they even seem to believe it to be true themselves.
It's self-evident. He's been more addled, more undisciplined. These are actually weasel words. He's if we can say that Joe Biden experienced some serious degree of cognitive decline and some serious degree of a deterioration of mental acuity that made him unfit in the eyes of the majority of Americans to get four more years in office, Donald Trump is easily as degenerated on both those fronts. I mean, the man is like, I mean, he's had, these things have been true about him for a little while, but in this last 5 weeks, it's been so extreme. And, you know, there have been moments when Trump has been able to pull himself together and behave like a relatively disciplined candidate for periods of time when he's really needed to. You've not seen that here. The guy spent 3 years building a campaign around how to beat that guy, Joe Biden. And to suddenly have this thing all change in front of his eyes like this, I think he's been poleaxed. That man, a guy who has done the things he's done over the last month, is not someone who you would say, oh, he's going to be able to drive a clear, consistent, rigorous, disciplined message over the course of the next 75 days.
And specifically on debate day on September 10th.
And throughout. In a short sprint like this, consistency, rigor, discipline, repetitiveness to some extent, he is not demonstrating right now a capacity as a candidate to do what is necessary to beat her. That could change, but today, there's not a lot of Republicans right now who look at Trump and go, yeah, he's like on his game. This is good Trump. You don't hear that very much.
But if it comes down to a few, tens of thousands of votes in three or four states, does any of it matter, really, the campaign? Because you kind of already know who's going to vote for Trump, who's going to vote for her.
She has the sheen of the new, right? Mm-hmm. And her worst liability was that no one knew who she is. And that's now her greatest asset. And it's her greatest liability, too. She's undefined. And she gets to sort of start anew. And there's this race to define her. There was a time when Trump was kind of a feral beast, you know, as a candidate. You kind of thought, well, he's not conventional, but there's something that's kind of this dark, feral thing where he understood the kind of id of a lot of American voters. And you could see how all these things that a lot of people found objectionable were like his superpower. He's not a feral beast right now. He's like a headless beast, kind of lurching around on the savannah with no clear sense of where to go.
John Heinemann, thanks so much for talking to us.
Absolutely. Totally fun. Thanks, you guys.
And a final thought from Chicago for the moment. There is an Americast podcast, Michelle. The latest one has dropped. I even mentioned you in one recently.
So I hear. I hear it's a nice mention, too. I'm just pausing out of surprise.
And you have to go. All are available on BBC Sounds, it says here.
I listen regularly, but that's another reason to do so. More from Justin in a minute, but at 23 minutes past eight, let us turn to the Paris Olympics, Paralympics, because we are on the verge of them. The opening ceremony is next week, and ahead of it, a champion paramarathon runner for Great Britain is trying to raise awareness about deficiencies in the prosthetic limbs available on the NHS, particularly for the young, and how they affect the chance of people who are disabled having active lives. Richard Whitehead has been talking to us alongside Taylor Lewis, who is 10 and lost both his legs and his hands after he had meningitis as a baby, and his mother, Terry. Richard first.
The real issue is that young people like Taylor and young adults aren't getting the appropriate provision that they truly deserve within the prosthetic industry. And that is to have prosthetics that are fit for purpose and then have the platform for success in their life that everybody deserves. And I look at the provision that is out there now and the provision that I got when I was Taylor's age, 10 years old, 35 plus years, it is exactly the same. And that is not right.
Because technology has moved on and there is much more available, particularly activity limbs, the ones suitable for sport and exercise. Is it that they are just not available on the NHS necessarily?
The provision that is out there isn't fit for purpose in the respect that young people don't get the provision at the time when they need it. And also they don't get the support after that as well. So the technology is available. There is a cost to that technology to it, like everything. The real problem is actually getting it at the right time. These young people are getting the prosthetics home and they're still in pain. The fit's not right. They're not able to play with their friends. They're not able to do sporting activity. They're not able to go to work because of this.
Taylor, tell us about the different kinds of limbs that you have and what they feel like.
I have blades, the ones that we call football legs, and stumpy ones, and that's all really.
Which ones are the most comfortable and allow you to be...
None of them, really.
None?
None of them. None.
They all feel painful when you wear them and use them?
Every time, yeah. What everything.
What does that mean? You said you've got some that are football legs. Can you play football in them?
Not for long.
Is that because you feel like they don't fit you properly, or they just don't feel like they're particularly good?
Heavy.
And you can hear the sadness in his voice, can't you? And it's really disappointing that one of the primary impacts that the NHS has regarding providing prosthetics is to have a positive effect on the health of the user when they leave the centre, and they're not even in that, they're not even having that impact. And when I look at Taylor and Taylor's family, and they deserve the same kind of support as every other person that accesses the NHS, and the provision at the moment is a second thought for young people like Taylor.
Terry, tell us what you see as Taylor's mum and how much he wants to be active and to move like the other children he sees of his age.
He gets awkward and sad when it comes to seeing his friends running around the playground at school, especially playing football, because all he wants to do is be able to join in. He's football mad, he's sport mad, he just wants to be as active as possible. But he will try, and then he will be in pain. He'll fall constantly. His hips and back hurts after a couple of minutes, and he then just has to go sit down and watch everyone play while he's sat watching. It's not nice to see.
And do you know that there are other kinds of prosthetic limbs, ones that would allow him to play football without pain, that are available?
Like I say, he has got his football, well, we call them his football legs. He's also got his blades, but that's all he has been offered. So I don't know. There's nothing else out there, to my knowledge, that the NHS can give him.
Taylor, what's the kind of leg that would make a real difference to your life? What do you dream of?
Lighter legs and comfortable as well.
Are you in pain every day?
Yeah, every day, back and hips.
What does that do to you? How do you keep your spirits up?
Just carry on doing it, but it still hurts when I do it.
Well, thank you so much for talking to us this morning, Taylor Lewis, Terry Lewis, and Richard Whitehead as well. And with that, we turn to today's sport with Gary.
Good morning. Just over 2 hours until the Test match is due to resume. An intriguing day in prospect as well, I think. England 259 for six. That's 23 runs ahead of Surrey. Smith 72 not out. Now the latest from the Women's Open Golf Championship. England's Charlie Hull leading after the first round. What's been happening today? Good morning to Ian Carter at St Andrews.
Hello again, Gary. Yes, a frustrating start for Charlie Hull, having taken that one-shot lead into this second round. She dropped a shot on her opening hole. She's playing the back nine first, so that bogey coming at the 10th. She has parred the 11th, so she remains now at four under par. We have a three-way tie for the lead because Nelly Korda, who's playing alongside Hull, the world number one, has parred her first two holes. So she's playing the 12th, her third, at four under par alongside Hull, with Ronnie Yin, the leader from yesterday, after a brilliant 4-under par 68. She is among the afternoon starters today.
And commentary right now for you on Sports Extra. Well, Chelsea won their Europa Conference tie 2-0, but the team were booed off the pitch at half-time. They have another new manager, their 10th in as many years. Well, I've been speaking to Howard Wilkinson about football management. He's just stood down as the chairman of the League Managers Association after 32 years. Howard was the last English manager to win the league with Leeds United.
Liverpool have beaten Manchester United. There's no question about it, the title has now been decided. Congratulations to Howard Wilkinson. Congratulations to Leeds United, champions of the last Football League.
When we set off this season, I never, ever, in my wildest dreams, thought the championship would be anything but a remote possibility, because of all the problems that you saw ahead in terms of number of games, players, squad, etc. It's unbelievable. I'm gobsmacked.
Howard, that was Leeds winning the championship after Manchester United lost to Liverpool. Commentary from Mike Ingham, and that was you speaking immediately afterwards, 32 years on. What do you think this morning, listening to that now?
As soon as that started and was played back to me,
it took me immediately back to that day. I can still see that day, and I can see the photographs that were taken on that day quite soon afterwards, because I didn't know it at the time, but there was assembled outside or in proximity to our house a number of people from various aspects of the media. I was just obviously delighted, elated, but at the same time found it quite difficult to see it as the reality on that day.
Yes, it must have been a nerve-jangling day waiting for that Manchester United result, Howard.
I didn't watch or listen to that game. I said, no, I can't do anything about it. And we actually had a very nice Sunday dinner. Towards the end of that Sunday dinner, our young son, who was upstairs at the time, came wandering down and said, Daddy, I think we've just won the title. And that picture's coming back to me as I say that.
Wallace is clear of the defence, moves forward inside the penalty area. Only Grobbelaar to beat, he checks, tees it up for Cantona, and Cantona scores for Leeds.
And tell me about managing Eric Cantona, who was such an influential player for you, Howard.
Eric was a one-off. He found it difficult playing in a team whose success depended on the success of all. To step outside, as it were, the governing rules of that, of how we played and how we were organised, we couldn't cater with. It's as simple as that.
What was the best thing about being a football manager?
All my working life has been in football, but I got paid for doing something that I would have done for nothing. My father left school when he was 14 on a Tuesday, and he was down the pit on a Wednesday. And he made sure, as I was growing up, he kept reminding me that I was not going to work down the pit, and therefore I should be very keen on seeking out other ways of earning a living that were not as difficult and hard as his was.
And so when people say sometimes football managers are under pressure, and you will have been under pressure, you will have thought back to your dad.
Yeah, yeah. There's pressure and pressure. The worst thing you can do when you're a manager is lose your job.
You spoke earlier about the pressures of the job. Gareth Southgate did a wonderful job as the England manager, but some fans gave him a bit of a difficult time at the European Championships. Are you angry that he's not still the England manager, because in a way those fans might have had a bit of influence?
I'm very angry. I am not only very angry, I'm also very disappointed, because I felt Gareth was the right man for the job, and I thought he was the right man to carry on in that job and to achieve even more success than we'd done up to now. And I think if he'd have stayed, the improvement in our performances would have continued. So for me, it was a shame that when we just, as it were, got all the marbles in place, outside factors not forced him, but in the circumstances, I can understand why he had to say, you know, I've had enough. And I think that's something that we'll look back on and regret.
Howard Wilkinson, it's been a pleasure to talk to you. Thank you very much indeed. And congratulations on just over 60 years in football. Thank you, Howard.
Thank you. Thank you.
Let's give you the racing tips for the big meeting at York. First of all, at 2:25, number 5, Quickthorn. And then at 25 minutes to 4, look out for number 9, Asphora.
Gary, thank you very much. And just after 9 o'clock, Kirsty Walker is going to be here with the reunion.
Things can only get better was blasting around the victory party. Portillo had fallen. The Conservative Party had been wiped out in Scotland and Wales. For Tony Blair's new Labour Party, the long years of opposition were over. To talk about those first frenetic 100 days will be Harriet Harman, one of the 5 women to be appointed to the Cabinet, Home Secretary Jack Straw, Tony Blair's Chief of Staff Jonathan Powell, Angie Hunter, the Prime Minister's long-time adviser, Gordon Brown's Political Secretary Sue Nye, and the civil servant who oversaw the transition of power, Sir Alex Allen. That's the reunion on Tony Blair's first 100 days, in half an hour.
And so do the weather, which is seeing the rain clearing to the east, leaving sunny spells for most. It is, though, going to be windy in southern and central areas, only breezy further north.
You're listening to Today on BBC Radio 4 from Chicago and London, and with Jane Steele reading the news.
The energy regulator Ofgem has announced that its price cap will increase by 10% from the 1st of October. It means an average household in England, Scotland and Wales will pay an extra £149 a year, although prices will still be lower than last winter. Kamala Harris has accepted her party's nomination to be their presidential candidate in November's election. At the Democratic National Convention in Chicago, she promised reforms to immigration and tax cuts for the middle class. A man has been charged with the murder of a delivery driver who tried to stop someone stealing his van in Leeds on Tuesday. Claudio Carol Conda, who was 42, was dragged along by the vehicle. 32-year-old Mark Ross is due before magistrates this morning. Jermaine Genus, who presented The One Show and appeared on Match of the Day, has said he is speaking to lawyers after he was sacked by the BBC. It's understood there were complaints about his workplace conduct.
Jane, thank you very much. It is just after 25 to 9. Is the Online Safety Act fit for the climate and reality we have seen in England and Northern Ireland in recent weeks? Misinformation contributing to hatred whipped up and expressed. Racism against Muslims and other people of colour, asylum seekers, refugees and migrants. The Mayor of London, who is the most high-profile Muslim politician we have, said after the riots that he did not think the Act was enough. Sir Max Hill KC joins us, independent reviewer of terrorism legislation formerly, and then Director of Public Prosecutions of England and Wales. That was until last October. He's now senior counsel with the law firm King & Spalding. Welcome, Sir Max.
Good morning, Michelle.
What did you think of that view expressed by Sadiq Khan? Do you think the Online Safety Act, part of which has not yet come into actual use, is fit for the climate we see?
Well, I think the Online Safety Act is helpful. It is a nudge in the right direction. It mandates all companies to take robust action against illegal content. So there is an opportunity in the first place for Ofcom to regulate strongly, and I know under Melanie Dawes they intend to do exactly that. But it is also a warning sign to companies, to the corporates, for better self-governance. And that, I think, is what we need to see now. If that doesn't happen, then I'm with the mayor that we'll need to revise the legislation again. But I hope that point won't come.
But the Act is primarily focused on harm to children, isn't it?
Well, it's to protect children in the first place, quite right too, but it is also to reduce harmful content. What we've seen in the last 3 weeks, and we've just been through this extraordinary operational period, rapid investigation, appropriate charging, quick results in court, significant sentences, yes, a squeeze on prison places, but that is being managed. That means that we have been witnessing crime, 21st century crime, happening on these online platforms. Every time, whether through the OSA or other means, people try to tell companies to do more, they're met with twin objectives or twin complaints. Firstly, you're interfering with free speech. Secondly, you're interfering with commercial interests and privacy concerns. Let's be very clear. Crime is not free speech. Riot is not lawful protest. And it cannot be in the commercial interest of the tech giants to provide platforms that amount to incitement to crime. We've seen that vividly on our streets, incited online in the last 3 weeks. This is the moment, using the Online Safety Act as a stepping stone for companies to self-regulate and to step up.
Perhaps it's too early to say this, but it doesn't feel as if there's a very different attitude being displayed from someone like Elon Musk, for example, the owner of X. Are you saying that to give the Online Safety Act teeth, we will have to see fines under the provisions that are there under the Online Safety Act, that it's only then that you expect behaviour to change?
Well, I know that Ofcom have the power to fine. It's quite significant. It's £18 million or 10% of qualifying worldwide revenue. So that's quite a stick. But let's just draw back for a second, Michelle. Football hooligans are banned from the terraces. Online incitors of riot should be banned from the service that they use to conduct that incitement. Surely that is very straightforward. That is a first step that all of these companies, and I'm not naming names, should take. But there's a greater opportunity for more regulation, more self-regulation, more compliance. And you mentioned I was the independent reviewer in 2017. That is when we saw, with the GAF, the attack on Westminster Bridge, the emergence of online radicalization, no longer face-to-face. Although I wouldn't go so far as to say these riots were terrorism, they are a vivid instance of online incitement, not requiring any face-to-face meetings, and a very clear line between what people were saying and writing online and what people were doing on our streets. What more evidence do you need to conclude that this is crime on online platforms? It's got nothing to do with free speech. There has to be a gear change to intervene and to stop what we saw a month ago happening again on our streets.
You mentioned the overcrowding in prisons and the wider problems in the justice system. The Times is reporting today an instruction to magistrates to delay jailing convicted criminals for several weeks. These are people who have been convicted, who are on bail, who are likely to be jailed, but the instruction is that their sentencing hearings should be postponed until at least September the 10th, presumably because that's the date at which the measures to reduce prison overcrowding are going to come into force. A good idea?
Yes. Let's be very clear about this. It's not the judiciary's fault that the prisons are full. Equally, I've seen Lord Justice Green's announcement. That is extremely rational. It's short term. It is not going to lead to the release of violent people on our streets. These are individuals already under the control of the courts who may have been convicted, but who magistrates have decided can be bailed pending their sentencing hearing. But where there is a significant risk that at that hearing they're going to be imprisoned, a 2-3 week delay will cause no harm. And there will then be greater capacity in the system. So it's a necessary short-term step. I would say that it is also an opportunity for a pause, now that we're in quieter times, to really think about how to resource right across the criminal justice system, because everybody coped incredibly well, in my view, with the overstretch in the last month. But that overstretch, although it was admirable, involves taking the troops from one part of the jungle to another to fight the fire. You can't do that all of the time. The only way out is greater resourcing. So let's have a pause, reflect, and make sure that everyone from prisons, probation, court service, police, and prosecutors is properly resourced so that they will be ready the next time there is a pressing issue.
Sir Max Hill, thank you very much. It is 17 minutes to nine now. A Labour MP responded to the news this morning that the typical household gas and electricity bill is about to go up by £150 a year by calling on the government to rethink its decision to means test winter fuel payments. As things stand, most pensioners will not now get the £100 to £300 help with their energy bills. Marta Lewis, the founder of MoneySavingExpert.com, joins us now. What do you think should now happen, Martin?
I think the government should rethink getting rid of the winter fuel payment the way it's done so. If we work through this, we're seeing a 10% average rise in the energy price cap on the 1st of October. I'm afraid to say that it's currently predicted on the 1st of January, it will rise again, although only slightly at that point. And by this time next year, we are still likely to be paying more on the energy price cap than we are right now. So these price rises, unless there's a radical change, are here to stay. Now, if you look at what that means for a pensioner, while energy rates are cheaper than last year, because we've seen drops since winter last year, over the 6 month winter period from October to March, somebody in a typical home would see a reduction of around £100 of spending compared to what they spent last year. Remember, last year was a winter energy crisis. We were still in what we were calling the crisis. Now let's look at the situation compared to last year of specific pensioner support. Well, the first thing, the thing that people aren't mentioning is last year there was a cost of living payment of up to £300 for every pensioner household. That's already gone. So they're already £300 down on specific support, even though the cost reduction is only £100. So net, that's £200 up. And now we've got getting rid of the winter fuel payment. Now, that is an up to £300 payment that has currently been universal and from this winter will be only primarily available to those on pension credit. Now, pension credit, and I would encourage anybody who's a low-income pensioner to claim it. I've been encouraging them to do so for years. There are 880,000 pensioners missing out who are eligible. But pension credit is a payment for those on income of less than £12,600. That's very, very low. So while I actually agree there's a very strong argument for getting rid of a universal winter fuel payment, I think the eligibility criteria is far too narrow. My suggestion would be, and what people have to understand is the policy difficulty in this, is it's a household payment, so it has to be over household income. That's data that people don't really have. So it's quite difficult to suddenly come up and say, how are we going to measure household income? Well, I worked with the previous government on a support package. I think it was May 2022. And a payment was then made to people in council tax A to D. So what you could do is say pensioners in council tax A to D should get the winter fuel payment. So that would raise eligibility above just those who are on pension credit. I have to say it is an imperfect solution, but it is a workable, quick solution. And I'm due to be meeting Rachel Reeves in a couple of weeks on various issues, and I will certainly be pushing that idea to her then, because I think the key for me is it's fine to drop universality, but we've gone from allowing everyone to have it to just having the absolute poorest pensioners on the very lowest incomes. And as always, it's those just above the threshold who miss out. And so we need to look at a broader eligibility criteria if you are going to effectively means test it. I support those calling for
Understood. Can I ask you fairly briefly to address one other issue, which is standing charges, with Jonathan Brearley of Ofgem also mentioned to us earlier. He said that they're looking at all of this, but if you reduce standing charges, you have to increase the unit rate that people pay for gas and electricity. And that means that families that particularly, you know, have high energy use, perhaps because someone is disabled, are going to be penalised.
Well, that's absolutely right. Now, I've been probably leading the charge on reducing the poll tax that is standing charges, the 338 quid a year you pay just for having the facility of gas and electricity, even if you don't use it. And let's remember, there are many elderly pensioners who don't turn their gas on in summer months, but they're still paying 30p a day just to have the gas meter. What I've long said is Ofgem can't do this alone. And I spoke to the last government and I've spoken to Ed Miliband about this. This move to drop standing charges, and there's a consultation out today, I haven't read it in full, it's very big and it's only just come out, has to be done in concert with specific help to help vulnerable high users who have it for medical or disability conditions. But the problem with our system is Ofgem is in charge of standing charges, government is in charge of support for vulnerable users. So you have to join the two up. So this has always been the problem in calling it. When I've spoken to Ofgem, they said, yeah, but the vulnerable users, we can't protect them. You spoke to the government, and they say, well, it's for Ofgem to deal with standing charges. And you want to grab both heads and bang them together and say, you two have to work together to make this work. Standing charges are a moral hazard. They mean that lower users reducing their usage do not get the benefit. And therefore, it's a disincentive. It's an anti-green incentive and it's anti-money incentive for lower users. So we need to reduce standing charges. Of course, that means you'll have to increase the unit rate because, you know, the government has decided, and this government might change the policy, that there's a net amount that energy firms are allowed to make based on wholesale rates. But that the change to standing charge needs to be bigger than the maximum 100 quid reduction proposed, but it needs to be done in concert with government action to support higher users.
Okay.
So I'm in favour of the consultation, but would like to see a bigger cut in standing charges, but we can't look at it in isolation.
Okay. Thank you, Martin Lewis. I think you've just done the on-air equivalent of banging heads together.
11 minutes to 9 is the time. The charity Alzheimer's Research UK has urged the government to intervene to make a landmark treatment available on the NHS in England. The drug is lecanemab. It's been approved for use in Great Britain, but the medicines watchdog NICE says that its benefit, the benefit it does provide tackling early stage dementia, are too small to justify the costs. Let us talk to Scott Mitchell, who is an ambassador for Alzheimer's Research UK, a campaigner on this subject, and also, of course, husband to the late Dame Barbara Windsor, who herself suffered from Alzheimer's. Scott Mitchell, good morning to you.
Good morning.
For families, the length and breadth of the country, this is going to be not just disappointing, isn't it? Not just frustrating, but more than that.
I think so. I think first, I think we have to applaud the dementia research community for, after 30 years of incredible hard work, coming up with a drug that we now know can slow down the devastating effects of Alzheimer's. You do have to catch it early. We understand this. But it is bittersweet because, you know, there's a million people living with Alzheimer's dementia at the moment. That's a million families affected by this. Now, I can't imagine, you know, 3.5 years ago when I lost Barbara, there wasn't this kind of treatment available. If you would have said to me then, you can have an extra 4 to 6 months of good health and quality of life for her at the beginning of that, I would have bitten your hand off. So I can't imagine how the families are feeling today, knowing there's something out there. But unless you have the resources to fund yourself, I believe in America it's the equivalent of something like £20,000 a year you'd have to pay for this treatment. All I can say is these treatments are going to develop. It's not a case of if now, it's a case of when. I just call upon the watchdog NICE, the government, the pharmaceutical companies, please, please work together. Please find a way to make this available. I know the NHS are under tremendous strain. Ironically, yesterday when this news broke and I was ready to do some interviews, I had a call to say my mum had been knocked off her feet in a gust of wind. I drove down to Sussex yesterday and spent the whole day until midnight last night in the bay of an A&E emergency department in Worthing. And I watched these incredible doctors and nurses working. So it's not them. It's not them at all. They do everything they possibly can. But we must prepare the NHS for the rollout of these drugs that are coming along. People deserve it. People really deserve it. I was listening to Martin Lewis just now. Once again, he's talking about the elderly being affected. A lot of people with dementia are more elderly. So, you know, we have to look after people.
We got to leave it there, but your message will be heard loud and clear, and particularly by the families of those affected. Scott Mitchell, thank you very much. And that brings us to 8 minutes to 9. What is she like then? Kamala Harris's big job last night was to establish herself in the minds of the nation. I've been talking to two people with an insight into the real Kamala Harris, her biographer Dan Moraine, and her friend, Congresswoman Sidney Kamlagadov.
Even though she is joyous and loves to laugh and has a megawatt smile, she is incredibly laser-focused. She is tireless.
She's really a hard campaigner. And she's run as an underdog before. She's an underdog today. I think if the election were held today, Trump would win.
And you think she'd be happy, actually, to be that? I'm getting from a kind of sense that actually that is where she quite likes to be.
I think she likes to run as if she's losing by 5 points.
Congresswoman?
Well, she was also an underdog when she ran for attorney general, and she ran to the left of Steve Cooley, who was the district attorney for Los Angeles, who was far more moderate, who had developed, I think, even stronger relationships with law enforcement across the state, and many expected him to win. And so her defeat of him, I think, was seen as a coup because San Francisco is seen of, you know, as the bastion of liberal progressive politics. And this woman was able to one-up Steve Cooley.
You've said now that she's run to the right of someone, she's run to the left of someone. Congresswoman, isn't that her problem? That people will say of her, she has no political core that we can identify and say that has always been Kamala Harris.
No, it shows her strength. You have to be able to evolve your policies, especially when we're talking about public safety, because we know that behaviors, we know that tactics, we know that circumstances change over time when you're talking about criminal justice and law and order. So I applaud the fact that she's been smart enough and sensitive enough to evolve her policies with the time.
The fellow she was running against, the incumbent district attorney in San Francisco, was a really liberal guy who didn't prosecute drug crimes. And one of the things she promised to do was to prosecute drug dealers. Okay? When she ran for California Attorney General, the guy she was running against was the Republican. And he was a moderate Republican, But she was a Democrat, so she was running as a Democrat. It wasn't as if she was running as a far lefty. She's a mainstream Democrat. She's a moderate.
Why did her previous run for the presidency, or at least for the candidacy, for the Democratic candidacy in 2020, why, Dan, did it go so wrong?
It was a muddled message. She ran away from being a prosecutor, which I think was a fundamental mistake. She was running against Biden, but then she was also running against Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren, people who are far more liberal than she is on the natural. You know, she's left to center, but she's not Bernie Sanders.
What would your explanation be, Congresswoman, for why that campaign petered out?
Well, I think she's pragmatic, and sometimes that runs contrary to being a populist. We were also in a moment where Black Lives Matter and so many of these other movements had taken form. Folks were listening to that kind of message of resistance. And when you're trying to speak to folks from California to Wisconsin to Texas to South Carolina, where they have different definitions of all of those issues and different ideas for solutions, you know, it can be tough. Fracking, for example, is a huge issue in California. It's also a huge issue in the South. And we're on very opposite sides of that discussion. And so how do you navigate that in a way that everyone can agree when you're also trying to keep it real and tell the truth, which is something that she does. And populism sometimes doesn't want you to do that.
She didn't emphasize her background as a prosecutor in 2019 when she ran. She pulled out before the first votes were counted because she knew she was going to lose. But now that she's running against Donald Trump, she's emphasizing that she was a prosecutor. I mean, she was a prosecutor who sent people who committed felonies to prison, and he's been convicted of 34 felony counts. It's a pretty clear juxtaposition.
Her tagline has remained the same, for the people. And when she first launched her presidential campaign, I remember her saying that. She said, when I would go in as a district attorney, as a prosecutor, the first words out of my mouth would be for the people. Well, when you're in the throes of a movement about criminal justice reform, people hear that in a very different way. Does that mean you're trying to prosecute us? Are you being responsive to how Black and brown and immigrant communities are feeling? Well, the landscape has changed tremendously. As Dan mentioned, you have someone who's been convicted of like 34 counts, who is running as a convicted felon, and now we are fighting for the people. And it also now means justice, freedom. And so I think we've expanded that construct in a way that can include more people.
It's really interesting, isn't it? Finally, she is running as a prosecutor. She's not running primarily as a Black woman, or indeed as a woman. And that seems to matter.
I think she's running as a child of immigrants. She's running as the product of a biracial family. She comes from a blended family. The United States is a blended nation. So many countries across Europe are also blended nations. And she is leaning into the diversity, which sometimes makes people uncomfortable, but the diversity of this country. And I think it opens and widens the aperture in a way where everyone can see themselves in her message.
Dan?
I agree. Everybody in our country of immigrants is of mixed parentage. I mean, almost everybody. But, you know, she doesn't have to run as a Black woman, a South Asian woman, as a woman. She's running on her record, and she's running on Trump's record.
Congresswoman Dameron as well, thank you both so much. And that's just about it. Michelle, I was promising that the cleaners would come and turf us out, and they're about to do that, actually, and everyone else has left. And, of course, they have left with a purpose, because whether or not they think that this has been a success, and generally the people here think it has, there is an awful lot of work for them still to do. And one further thought, no Beyonce and no Taylor Swift.